welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We're here to talk about stuff this week on the show. We have a lot of topics.
Yes, we do.
Not as many as last week.
It will never be as many as last week. Never again. Never again. That is my solemn vow.
I did hear positive response to the episode, not necessarily to its length. So yeah, it was a four-hour episode. We did that. We will try not to do that again.
Yeah.
It's just E3 is insane.
It's E3, Doctor Who, and Twin Peaks. It's like, what an absurd conflagration of different things that normally would all be totally separate.
Yeah. I not that I'm going to be happy to see Doctor Who end, but I am going to be happy that we'll have one show from the weekend to talk about, not two.
This show is not designed to talk about this much stuff in one week.
No, not at all. But this week we do have a good amount of stuff. We've got some news we're going to talk about. We've some fun and some crazy news that broke like right before we started recording. Because this is a Tuesday. We record Tuesday nights now. Sean finally saw Wonder Woman.
Yes, I did.
So we're going to talk about that. And I think we can be pretty free with spoilers. Because if you haven't seen it, I don't know who hasn't seen that yet. Its box office has been incredible. It's funny, it opened like way less than Suicide Squad, but because it's a good movie, people have been going to see it, and it's already made more.
It's funny how that math works out,
We're going to talk about a great Doctor Who.
Yeah, The Eaters of Light.
Excellent episode, and a great Twin Peaks.
Yes. Although, Twin Peaks continues to dazzle and amaze.
I don't know what a non-great episode of this Twin Peaks would look like.
Yeah.
I don't think it could happen.
It is so sort of like consistently amazing and consistently just its own bizarre thing.
Yeah, this was a very different episode, I thought.
Yes, it was a very plot-heavy episode, but it felt good. It felt very good.
Yes, I love this. We have so many fun things to talk about today.
Yeah.
So why don't we start with some stuff? Sean, what have you been up to?
Not a whole lot. I've sort of, you know, I came out of my E3 fugue state and, like, stumbled into Wonder Woman finally and was like, oh, hey, this is a pretty good movie. That's fun. And then I was like, okay, I should probably play a video game. And I was about to play a new video game. And I was like, before I play a new video game, let me play another old video game. And so I replayed through Wolfenstein The New Order off of the back of that just the crazy fucking awesome New Colossus trailer from E3. And I thought, okay, this is going to be, like, the best time to play this, where it's like, I've got some free time, like, there's not a lot of other games on the horizon, so I have some time to go through my backlog of new games like Nier Automata and Neo, and I also don't want to replay through The New Order too close to Wolfenstein 2 coming out, because I don't want, you know, like, to get fatigued from the shooting gameplay or something like that. So I thought, like, great time to sort of replay through that game. That game has two different storylines that, like, because, it, you know, it's like alternate history, World War II, and at the very beginning of the game, you're playing toward, like, near the end of World War II, and then you kind of make a choice that can split the timeline, and so then it jumps forward basically 20 years into the 60s, and that's where the meat of the game is. And so I only ever played the game through once when I originally got it, so now I got to play through the Fergus storyline, and that was fun. And it's just, that game fucking kicks ass. Like, it is a great game. It's a really solid first-person shooter campaign with a really awesome story, a great sense of style, and I feel like there were a lot of people, when it came out, didn't really know what to make of the game and its weird tone, and made a lot of people sort of, like, slept on that game, and I feel like now, because the Wolfenstein 2 trailer was fucking so awesome, I've seen so many people kind of rediscovering it, because also the game went on, like, a super deep, like, $10 sale right after E3, and that's been great to see.
Yeah, I feel like that game also came out just on the cusp of that first-person shooter resurgence we've had lately.
Yes, it was like right at the beginning of that, because it was like early 2014.
So I think people didn't know to pay attention to it in some way. You know, like, I missed it, and I would like to play it at some point. I don't know if I'll have time for it in Wolfenstein 2 this year, because Sean and I are going to have to divide and conquer this fall.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen the schedule. So, you know, that'll obviously be a you game.
Yeah.
I'll take Metroid.
There you know. You go.
Yeah, but no, it's no, I'm glad to see that too, and at some point I will figure that out. I'll have to look at one of those sales too. I hadn't seen that, so I'll have to pick that up.
Yeah, that game is fucking awesome. I was very happy to see that it held up very well. Although one of the things that's interesting about it is, because it is from early 2014, it's like a very early game from this generation of consoles. It's one of like the first like sort of AAA games, I feel like, on those consoles that was like, this is only on the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One and PC. It is not coming to 360 PS3. And now that we're like, that's a three-year-old game at this point, and we're deep enough into the console cycle that you go back and play it, I'm like, oh, these graphics don't look that great. Like, they look fine. Like, I'm not saying they're terrible or anything, but you definitely can tell we have moved on, and like, developers, now that we're into like the second game that most developers are in for this console cycle, you know, like Wolfenstein 2, or for some developers, it's like the third game on these consoles, like, we can tell that they're getting a lot better at sort of, like, eking the power out of the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. And I thought, like, oh, that was, it was, like, an interesting thing. It was, like, when I, like, halfway through the 360 generation, went back and replayed through, like, Dead Rising 1, I was like, oh, right, okay, this is what video games looked like in 2006. And even though it's on the same console, games look way better than this, even though I thought Dead Rising 1 looked amazing when it came out.
Exactly, yeah, that happens all the time. Well, speaking of slightly older games,
yeah,
I've been dipping into my back catalog because I did buy Horizon Zero Dawn on the sale, but I just have not wanted to start like a new game at the moment. I'm still kind of in my mode of where I'm having fun playing with the past.
Yes, that's what the summer is for with video games, I feel.
Absolutely. And y'all know I've been really getting into the Zelda series in the last year or two.
Really?
And basically because Breath of the Wild was coming out, and I love that so much. And I played a bunch of Zelda games leading up to it, and then I played Breath of the Wild, and I've loved that. But I had to, like, stop making myself go back to Breath of the Wild and, like, just wait for the DLC and have something to do, you know? So I went back, and I've been playing the two HD remasters they did on the Wii U.
Yeah.
Because, and I'm trying to, like, fill out, because I've almost now played every 3D Zelda game. And so I've played The Wind Waker in the last week, and then I'm about 26 hours into Twilight Princess.
So you've, so like, really gotten into your first dungeon in Twilight Princess.
It feels like that sometimes.
Now you know what I talk about when I talk about how fucking slow the opening of that game is. Although it's, I think the HD version actually, like, speeds it up, because some of the things you have to, like, collect those... Tears of Light.
Yeah.
I think they, like, reduce that by, like, a third or something.
No,
ridiculous.
They do. And so I want to talk about both of them, because I think they're super interesting games. Neither one is necessary, although I'm not done with Twilight Princess, and that is a game that actively gets better as it goes along.
Yeah, that is true.
But, like, neither of them are necessarily in, like, my top two or three Zeldas, but I still have not played a Zelda game that has not wowed me in one way or another. Like, that is a series kind of dense with hits. And The Wind Waker, I think, unambiguously, people love that game.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they should. It's an amazing game. It's a masterpiece. I think Wind Waker is fascinating because it is so brazenly unfinished in parts. Like,
oh yeah, yeah. Like I never finished Wind Waker just because I got to that, like, last part of the game where it's like find the Triforce. I'm like, I'm pretty good.
Which they really fixed on the HD version. Like, I shouldn't say fixed. Like, they didn't put a new dungeon in there, but, like, I had no problems with it. And then I was like, because I always have my brother Thomas around, who is the world's biggest Zelda fan, to, like, tell me about these things. I'm like, you had to do what in the original? Like, that is... I should say this right off the bat with Wind Waker. I think that might be the best HD remaster I've ever seen for anything. Just on the level of one, it is so utterly gorgeous. What they did to that game... I mean, that game always looked good on the GameCube and everything. It's got a very timeless art style. But they did such a nice job taking that timeless art style and making it look kind of modern and sleek and just as perfect as it can with modern technology in a way where you look at Wind Waker HD and if you told me that game was made yesterday, I'd say, sure, it looks utterly timeless. It looks like it totally could have been made yesterday.
Right.
You would say there are some things about, like, mechanically, that's weird that they kept that in the year 2017.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
I mean, I almost feel like a lot of, like, the Wii U era, like, HD, like, and now, like, moving to the Switch, the HD era Nintendo games kind of borrow some stuff by, like, the color palette and everything from Wind Waker.
Oh, totally. And yeah, but, like, I was going to say, it's not just that. Like, the other improvements they made are substantial. And again, I have not played through the entire GameCube game. I've played a good amount of it, but not played through the whole thing. And so I would constantly be hearing Thomas say, you know what you actually had to do here in the original? And I'm like, what? Because there are things like, the sailing in that game is a really interesting mechanic. And it took me a while to kind of get into the groove of it and appreciate what they were doing with it. Because it's not at all like a modern open world kind of thing. It really is this interesting, almost strategic thing you're doing where you're sailing to a point and there are going to be certain things along the way that you see in the ocean, whether it's a piece of treasure or something on one of your charts and you're looking out for that. You might have to fight an enemy. I think it's actually a very interesting thing once you get into the groove of it. And ultimately, I really liked going around and, like, charting and making my whole map of the world and stuff. I think there's a lot of little pieces in both Wind Waker and Twilight Princess where you can feel Breath of the Wild coming. Like, here are the building blocks starting to emerge. But, like, one of the things is, in Wind Waker HD, they give you this item called the Swift Sail, which replaces the normal sail for your boat, and that means you sail, like, twice as fast, and you never have to control the wind. It just goes where you want to go, and you never think about it. Totally seamless, like you would expect this kind of thing to be. In the GameCube version, as I learned from Thomas, you had to pull out your Wind Waker and change the wind every single time you wanted to go in a different direction.
Yes.
That's insane.
Yeah, no, like, I've found the sailing to be one of the more tedious parts of Wind Waker, and one of the main reasons why I stopped playing it at some point.
Totally, and I can totally understand that. I think they improved it enough that I got over the hump with it and learned to like it. It's not my favorite part of that game, and it does feel like... But it's also like I view it kind of in its time, and I think it's a really interesting thing they tried to do, you know, like, because it's mechanically a pretty direct sequel to Ocarina of Time, but I do like how many little risks, and sometimes big risks, like the art style Wind Waker takes, which are fascinating. But what I was going to say about how brazenly unfinished the game feels is like, the, you know, clearly like the game starts with the normal Zelda thing of you're going to collect three things, but they only did two dungeons. So the third thing, they just give you. Mm-hmm. There's the thing at the end with the Triforce quest. And just moments where you're like, okay, something's missing here. But the game is so confident in everything it does, and the storytelling in that game is so great. Like, it is very much in that Ocarina of Time style. Those little silences, they're very well-directed cutscenes where the images say so much. The characters are so expressive in that art style. The story just kind of moved me more and more the more I played it. And the ending to that game, I mean, everyone remembers, obviously, Link shoves the sword through Ganon's face, and that's amazing. But that whole ending is fucking phenomenal, where, like, you have this whole thing where the Triforce actually comes out and Ganondorf's about to make a wish on it, which I don't think has ever happened in another Zelda game, where like, you make a wish on the Triforce at the end of Link to the Past, but it's not, like, the big threat going on. And then, like, the King of Hyrule in ghost form comes out, and there's this whole dialogue where the dialogue is beautifully written in that game for Ganondorf and the King of Hyrule as they basically debate philosophically what should be done about the sins of the past, and the King of Hyrule saying, we just need to leave the world the way it is and let these young people forge their own direction and not be bound by our fuck-ups anymore. And it's actually, I think, a pretty thematically rich ending to a Zelda game. I really like where that goes. And so I came out of Wind Waker, like, it took me a little while to get into for a number of reasons. Some of the sailing stuff, you know, other little things. I think that game only has five dungeons. The last three are terrific. The first two are a little, like, they're not bad, they're just very Zelda 101.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't excited for a while, but the more I played it, particularly once you get to the big scene in the middle of the game, it's not really even the middle, but, you know, the first third, where you go under the water and you see Hyrule flooded and you get the Master Sword, which is one of my favorite Master Sword sequences.
Yeah.
In our subgenre of Zelda scenes.
Sure, yeah.
I would rank that one highly. That game just gets better and better as it goes along, and by the end, I was so in love with it that I was planning to, like, maybe jump into Horizon next, but I was like, I'm really riding this wave with Zelda right now. I should just continue and plow through these 3D games at the moment. And I had Twilight Princess sitting right there. And I'm like, if anything will push me through the opening hours of Twilight Princess, it's the enthusiasm I'm already riding.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. And so yeah, Twilight Princess. I think that's a flawed game.
Oh yeah.
In obvious ways.
Yes.
And we can talk about those. I also think when that game is on, it is really on. And I find it really great when it lets itself be great. I think it's, you know, again, I have not finished it yet, and I'm not ranking the Zelda games at the moment. It is, in many ways, my least favorite of the ones I've played, but it also does some things better than any of the other games. So it's like, it's a really fascinating game to look at, you know, that is a game that does not, if you're making the comparison to, like, Breath of the Wild as another, like, system launcher, it doesn't move to me with the same confidence that game does, but, like, it is interesting where it falls flat and where it soars, and kind of the gap between those. Like, what makes the opening slow isn't just that the story is overtold.
Oh, yeah.
And that there's too much writing, and a lot of scenes move too slowly, and there's too much tutorial. All of that is an issue. For me, one of the biggest issues is that that game actually is really beautiful at various points later in the game, and they foreground in that game the early hours, like the first 10 to 15 hours, an awful lot of what happens is in that version, that game's version of the Dark World, the Twilight Realm.
Yeah.
And that's where you do the Wolf Link stuff early on in the game. And I actually like Wolf Link as a concept on his own, and later on when you can switch between them, I think it works really well.
Sure.
Early on when the game just is like, you're going to be Wolf Link for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And we're not going to really give you anything interesting to do as Wolf Link. That's my issue with Wolf Link. You want to turn Link into a wolf, that's fine. You just got to do something interesting with him. And initially, it doesn't do that. And the other problem is because that's all in the Twilight Realm. In the Twilight Realm is where you get the majority of the exposition. It's where you get the majority of, like, the fetch questy type things, which is what you're talking about with, like, the tiers of light you have to go find. And here's the biggest problem. The Twilight Realm is the ugliest thing I think I've ever seen in a Nintendo game.
Yeah, and you're playing the HD remaster.
Yes, and I think, you know, I can see what they were going for because you want to make this contrast between the natural beauty of Hyrule and this horrible Twilight Realm. The way I would do that, frankly, with the power of, like, the GameCube, is go super stylized and have, like, the Twilight Realm be all sepia or something, like, really go for it. And instead it's just, it looks like someone smeared Vaseline on the lens.
It's just muddy and
it's
weird.
It's really muddy and weird, and, like, you just spend too much time there, and some interesting things happen, but it's kind of too far in between, and then, you know, you'll get to be real Link again, and you'll get to do something really cool for a couple hours, and then you'll go back to being the Wolf. And again, it's not that I don't like running around as the Wolf. There's some fun things you can do as the Wolf, but in those early hours, it's just so on rails with what you have to do.
And then, like, one of my issues with the Wolf stuff is that it's kind of like a little bit of what they did with Majora's Mask, but at least in Majora's Mask, like, it's a much shorter part of the game at the beginning where you are Deku Link for that stretch of time before you can turn into the Mask and become normal Link. Is like, when you are in the transformed state in Twilight Princess, when you are Wolf Link, you are so restricted as a player in so many ways. And it's like, you just want, like, I want to be able to run around and use items and solve puzzles and be the character in a Zelda game. I want to be Link. And as a Wolf, like, all you can do is run around and do, like, a bad version of Zelda combat. Because I think, like, even the combat as the Wolf is worse. Yeah. And because you're, like, restricted in what you can do in so many ways, every single combat encounter as the Wolf, like, feels like it plays out the exact same way every single time, and you get sick of the combat as the Wolf, like, the third time you do it. Or at least I did.
No, and I totally get that, because when... And again, this is why the game gets so much better as it goes along, because if you can power through that stuff, and I can totally understand some of the early hours kind of killing your enthusiasm, if you get through all that, and you get to the big turning point in the story and in the game, and where the game really opens up for you, and then Wolf Link is just a tool in your arsenal.
Yeah.
I love it. Because it's just, I can turn into the Wolf whenever I want. Okay, here, that's what I need to solve this puzzle. Or, this is an enemy. Okay, that's a Wolf Link enemy. Or, oh, I'm in the snow now. Link can't walk in the snow. Do I need boots? Oh, no, actually, the Wolf can do it. And when it's that, it's just another tool in your arsenal, and it's fun, and it's different, and I like that, and it varies the pace, because then you're never Wolf Link for, like, an hour at a time. It's for minutes and little chunks at a time, and it's a really fun way to explore the world, and the game, I think, very organically kind of blossoms at that point. But yeah, it just... And it's not a short part at the beginning of the game. I mean, it's the first three dungeons, and each dungeon has attached to it a long Wolf Link section where you collect the tears. And I will say that none of that really got under my skin too much until the third tier collecting section, which is all the stuff at Lake Hylia. And scatter the tiers over, like, half of Hyrule in that one. And they make you do multiple boss fights as Wolf Link, which should never be a thing, as you just said. Because the combat, it's fine for what it is if you don't lean on it too much, you know? I don't expect Wolf Link to fight as well as, you know, Human Link does. But when you give him a boss fight, it doesn't work. So, like, that whole section made me tear my hair out, and then I think the third dungeon is the only dungeon in that game I'm even slightly disinclined towards, because I think the game has fantastic dungeons. So, like, that part is kind of a slog, and then you get through it, and then when the game opens up, there's so many kind of fun things to do, and I think a lot of, like, just the story itself kind of starts breathing, where there are nice hints of the kind of Zelda humor and wackiness in the early hours of that game, like the monkey stuff in the first dungeon, which starts annoying. And they stick with it hard enough that it becomes really endearing in a weird Nintendo way.
Or the terrifying mutant chicken that you find in all the dungeons now.
Right, right, right. Ukuku or whatever his name is. Yeah. So there's little hints of that. But then, like, after that point, you really start to get it, I think, in a well-balanced way. And the game feels like just a really good, solid Zelda game in a lot of different ways. You know, I don't think the game ever becomes the most beautiful Zelda or Nintendo game, but there are definitely moments when you're out in Hyrule Field or in the Snowpeak Ruins and the mountains and stuff where you're like, this is really nice looking. It's nice looking Sursa GameCube era with what they were trying to do, but that looks really beautiful. And it's like, I wish they had foregrounded some of this earlier on to give you some light to hold on to in those early hours, you know? And that HD remaster is an interesting one to talk about, because clearly not as much work went into it as Wind Waker did. But on the flip side, I don't know how much you could do to it without a ground-up remake. What it looks to me like is that era on the PS3 when they took a bunch of PS2 games and did HD remasters like the Metal Gear Solids and God of War and all those stuff. And they tended to look really good, but you could tell they didn't, like, put years of work into it or anything. And it totally looks like that. And obviously the GameCube would be the PS2 era. And it so it looks like that kind of upgrade, which means that the things that looked good then look really good, and the things that don't really suffer, you know, which I think is true of, like, you know, Metal Gear is actually the one I kept thinking of, because this game looks a lot like the HD remaster of Metal Gear Solid 3. For whatever reason, I kept thinking of those textures, those kind of jungle and
tree textures. I can totally see, like, the grass textures in particular. Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah, so, but no, I you know, so what I mean when I say it has good things about it, too, like, and what's carried me through the game to now I'm, like, 26, 27 hours in, I think I beat Wind Waker was about 30, and clearly it'll take me a little more for Twilight Princess. But
Twilight Princess is very long.
It is. It's clearly the longest Zelda up to, like, Breath of the Wild, which varying lengths and stuff. But But what I was going to say is there are some moments even in the first like 10, 15 hours that like narrative-wise and presentation-wise soar. There's the really famous scene that I'd kind of forgotten was in the game where you have to do that big horseback chase against like the bubbling kings. Yeah. And then there's the thing on the bridge. And obviously, games have gotten better at big cinematic moments like that, but that one is still really cool and awe-inspiring. So there's some things like that. There's some zany narrative turns. I love the whole thing with one of the kids you're rescuing is Mallow, and he opens the Mallow Mart, and really stick to the ridiculousness of that throughout the game, and I love it. There's still things like that. But really what has taken me through that game is the dungeons. I think Twilight Princess has absolutely exemplary dungeon design, not just in terms of how the dungeons are laid out as, you know, big, complicated, like, multi-room puzzles, but as, like, the visual design of them. They're all very different. They're all very cool. They very much remind me of Metroid Prime in kind of their atmosphere.
Sure.
And some of the overall depth to it. I just did this morning the Snowpeak Ruins, which is the one everyone says is, like, that's the famous one people mention from that game. At least
what's the item you get in that one?
The ball and chain.
Okay,
yeah. And that dungeon is phenomenal. It is one of the only 3D Zelda dungeons to me that, like, fully lives up to, like, a Link to the Past era dungeon design. And that's in just the Yeti's mansion. The Yeti is an amazing character. You just go in his house and you're looking for shit. It's amazing. He's making soup and you keep bringing him things. And I love that the item, the ball and chain, it's not like some ancient relic Link finds in a treasure chest. He takes it off an enemy and is like, I might have a use for this. And then even the way he uses it is so inelegant where he just has to like fucking chuck it. And it's actually kind of amazing because you go into that dungeon and you see all these ice sculptures and you're like, oh, I'm going to get fire arrows, because that's what happens here, is you get fire arrows and you melt them.
Right.
No, you're going to get a giant metal ball and you're going to smash those things, and it's wonderful. And yeah, and the dungeon before that is the desert one where you get the spinner, which is...
Right, the weird skateboard thing.
Yeah, but that's an awesome dungeon. Like, they have all been... And then the other best one is the Goron one in this game. I forget what they call it, but it's...
The one with, like, the magnet boots...
Yeah, the iron boots, yeah. But they have this magnetism where that dungeon feels like Metroid Prime Zelda and Super Mario Galaxy had a baby. And it's amazing. So there's a lot of stuff in those dungeons that is great. And, you know, to me, in classic Zelda games like this, classic style Zelda games, the dungeons are my favorite parts. And so I'm very happy playing this game.
Sure.
If the dungeons are not the thing that, like, primarily take you through Zelda, I can understand getting frustrated with Twilight Princess.
Yeah.
To me, it's like... It's also just video game archaeology to me. I find it
fascinating. Yeah, because you're coming back to it years later. Yeah.
So I find it fascinating critically to play through this and kind of see the evolution of Zelda. Because as much as they are doing some things better than ever, like I think that's a game where they really, the 3D dungeon design is at its peak. You can also feel where things of the traditional Zelda format are starting to break down, which would necessitate, you know, years later when you get to Breath of the Wild and stuff, how they start to rethink that.
Yeah. One other element of you playing the HD remaster is that you do not have to fucking swing your wrist around every single time you want to hit someone with a fucking sword.
No.
Which, like, is something that at first seems like, eh, whatever, it's fine. It works as an input. Like, it never is like, oh, I'm accidentally slinging my sword or I'm not swinging my sword when I want to. It's just eventually at some point, you get real fucking tired of swinging your wrist every time you want to swing your sword.
I totally get it. And yeah, I mean, I feel very lucky to play these games for my first time with these very polished, definitive versions.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I think gets lost in the discussion about Twilight Princess because of the motion control stuff is it has outstanding combat.
It's got the best combat in any Zelda game.
Yeah, and I thought I was going to say that about Wind Waker because Wind Waker is outstanding on that level and then Twilight Princess just improves it. But I think you could very easily not see that if you're playing with motion controls. When it's just buttons, it's like, this is hyper-polished. The enemy variety is great. It's a good challenge. Because Wind Waker has great combat, but it's not as challenging as it needs to be. Like, that's... Yeah. I don't think I ever even had to, like, use a fairy in Wind Waker. But, like, with Twilight Princess, it's a nice balance of challenge and everything. And the combat... Just, like, there's a lot of polish on the game systems in that one. Even if some of the story stuff, I think they overreached.
Yeah.
But... and they were very clearly trying to do Zelda of the Rings. Because
parts
of it look like a Peter Jackson movie, but you couldn't really make it look as good as you need to on the game.
Yeah, it's like a Peter Jackson movie if all the dialogue has to be in text, and like at some point the pacing of those cutscenes just get ridiculous when you can't have voice acting in them.
Yeah, yeah. This game so far does not. It has some cool cutscenes to me. Like there's still like the visual design of the villain Zant is wonderful, and they use that great. But like it doesn't have the same kind of magical moments that the other 3D Zeldas have to me, where And Breath of the Wild, I think, was able to do this too, even though it had voice, and maybe because it had voice acting, you could bring back some of those, the quiet and the pause and just the way the scene gets to cut and everything. When you put that much text in, that gets harder.
Yeah.
But it's still, it's a fascinating game to play. So, and of course, these are games everyone's played, but I'm just finding them fascinating. And, you know, Skyward Sword is the last one I'll have left to play.
That's the one I haven't touched at all.
Yeah, my brother, actually, he's been watching me play Zelda games, and he's like, fuck no, I want to play Zelda games. So the only game, like, I wasn't playing at the time, because we only have one disc for each, was Skyward Sword, so he started playing that, and I've seen him doing that a little bit. And since that game has no HD remaster, and he has a 4K monitor, it doesn't look so great.
Yeah, that's also what it seems like. They're in a tough pickle, unless they can find a way to get the Joy-Con to accurately enough replicate what the Wiimote did. That would be a hard one to HD remaster for obvious reasons.
Yeah, I think they'll be able to do it, and they probably will, knowing that Zelda games take so long to develop, they tend to have a lot of remasters in the middle.
Yeah.
We'll probably get that at some point, but yeah. The other thing I should say is I love playing both of these on the Wii U. Outstanding use of the gamepad, particularly on Wind Waker, because like the charting and the map stuff is so in-depth. Having that on a second screen, that's outside of like Mario Maker, which is a separate thing, that's the best use of the gamepad I've ever seen. It felt super natural. I never wanted to play it any other way. Twilight Princess is less in depth on that level because it doesn't have as much of the map stuff, but I still really appreciate just being able to glance down at my map in a dungeon rather than like pause and bring it up and
Shuttle through all the floors.
Because I've played almost every 3D Zelda game in a way with like two screens.
Because
of the 3DS and then the Wii U, the only one I haven't would be Breath of the Wild. So
it's funny because I've only ever played any of these games in their original form. Like, depending on how you count the Wii versus GameCube version of Twilight Princess, but whatever.
Yeah. So that is also the hardest thing, is sometimes when I have to look up stuff for Twilight Princess, and a video will be the Wii version, and I have to mentally, like, go, okay, reverse this, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Because they mirrored it, and it's weird.
Yeah, you look up a walkthrough, it's like, okay, every time he says right, you go left.
Yeah. I luckily found an HD-specific walkthrough, and God bless the people who went through and meticulously changed every direction note in their walkthrough.
Good.
But yeah. Anyway, so that's my stuff. Want to move on to some news?
Let's move on to some news.
All right. We'll do E3 follow-up at the end.
Okay.
Because, here's the thing, a couple of pieces of news broke right before we started recording.
Yeah.
We might as well just start with those.
Yes, because I'm really excited to talk about these, because it's fucking crazy.
Yeah, so we're going to go kind of backwards
in
recency. So, like an hour before we started recording, we got the news from The Hollywood Reporter, broke this story, and then it went everywhere else, that the Han Solo standalone Star Wars movie,
which still does not have a title.
Does not have a title, but is dated for May of 2018, less than 11 months from now. That was being directed by Phil Miller and Chris Lord, the directors of 21 Jump Street, The Lego Movie, and other delightful films that sounded like they should have been bad, and that's what we were hoping this would be.
Yeah.
They have quit, probably been fired from the movie. I think if you read between the lines, I think they were probably fired.
Yeah.
And at first you read that and go, oh, that sucks, but that happens a lot. Maybe they'll find another director. And then you realize, wait, they had started shooting.
Yeah, this movie comes out in a year.
Yeah.
They are deep into shooting this movie.
And then you go, when did they start shooting? And if you're me, you start digging through press releases in your emails to find the like release they sent out with the picture. January 30th. They have been shooting this film since January 30th. So we are coming up on, in 10 days, the five-month mark of shooting this movie. 5 months is longer than most movie shoots. By the reports I'm seeing now, they were only about 3 weeks from finishing it. And they have been kicked off the movie.
Yeah.
This is nuts.
Uh-huh.
Like, take away any enthusiasm for Star Wars or whatever. This could be anything. This could be a live-action Charlie Brown remake. I don't know. And it was being directed by Joss Whedon for some reason. If you fired Joss Whedon from the Charlie Brown remake 3 weeks before shooting was to end, you would also go, this is insane.
Yeah.
What do they do with this?
Because, when I first heard the news, because I had kind of forgotten when this movie was supposed to come out. And I thought, oh, this is weird. I guess, maybe Disney is going to start having the Warner Brothers DC problem and just can't keep a director attached to a project. And I was like, but wait, no, the movie comes out a year from now. And then looking, like you said, at the full report, it's like, oh, shit. Like, I don't know if I've ever... Like, obviously there are some times where there's, something like this kind of, like there's bad blood in the production and, reshoots happen or something like that. That's kind of a little bit of the story that went around about, Rogue One when it was nearing its completion. But you never hear about, directors full-on just off of the project when it's almost done.
And with Rogue One, I mean, Gareth Edwards did stay through the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so it was... There was some trouble, but it wasn't, a negative for, the people involved.
Yeah.
this is insane. Like, I have been racking my brain trying to come up with an allegory, because the only way you can figure out what will happen next is to look at past precedents.
Right.
I can't think of any direct ones. The closest I can come, you have to go back to the year 1981 and Superman 2.
Right, with Richard Donner.
And even that is a little different, because Richard Donner started out shooting Superman 1 and 2 as one big movie that was going to be split. Eventually they came up against deadlines, and so he shelved what they had shot of Superman 2 and said, we're just going to focus on finishing Superman 1. They took the ending from Superman 2, put it in 1 and all that, and then they released Superman 1 and they were going to come back. And in that break, the Salkins, who were also just known crooks in Hollywood, so that's a little different. That doesn't really exist anymore, that you just have people who are just out-and-out crooks.
Right.
Fired Richard Donner, got Richard Lester in, made him film 51% of the movie, and then took Richard Donner's name off, which I don't think you can do anymore.
No.
You know, union stuff. So that's the closest I can think. But even then, one, that's 30 years ago,
yeah.
Almost 40. I just don't, this makes no sense. What the hell do they do? What self-respecting director would want to come in and finish this thing?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, here's the craziest thing. If you are Kathleen Kennedy and the people at Lucasfilm and Disney, Bob Iger, all those guys, and you're saying, we're willing to take the PR hit on shutting down this movie 3 weeks before it's done, bringing in someone else to do something else with it, you must really hate what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and maybe it's a good movie and Miller and Lord were doing something crazy with it and awesome, and they were like, we need it to be safer or something. Or maybe they did something really bad, which I'm inclined not to think because their track record is really good.
Yeah.
But like, this had to have been something catastrophic, and then what the hell do you do to fix it? Do they keep their name on the movie?
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the things I'm thinking about.
Do they go Alan Smithy on it? What happens?
Yeah, it's just like, it's so bizarre. Because it's especially like, it's such a high-profile example, too. Because it's like, This isn't like a small movie. It's the next fucking Star Wars movie. Like, I mean, sure, it's one of the spinoff ones, but it's a fucking Star Wars movie from Disney. You know, it's...
This also came insane. This came really out of left field. One of the film bloggers I follow on Twitter is this guy, Gregory Elwood, and he has a podcast, I guess, and he interviewed one of the co-stars of this film, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, someone who's been in the running for the next Doctor, if we want to make a Doctor Who.
Okay, there
she's
we go.
Always reported on the tabloids.
Yeah.
That means she's probably not going to be the Doctor, guys.
Yeah.
Anyway, but she did a podcast with this guy, and he asked her, and he was tweeting about this, he asked her at the end, like, you shot that Han Solo movie, you finished your scenes, how was that? And she said, oh, it was so much fun. Miller and Lord looked like they were having the time of their lives. It was great. And we've heard other indications of that. Like, this sounded like a fun set.
Right.
So, what happened? It's so bizarre. I mean, I don't know what could happen for you to do... Like, I can understand you finish the movie and then redo things in reshoots. That's like what happened with Josh Trank's Fantastic Four.
Right.
Where it was like, this is a disaster. Go away, Josh Trank. We'll do something with this and probably make it even worse, but fuck it. You know? That's what you usually do. You don't just upend everything. I mean, because then you get into, they're going to have to suspend production for an indefinite amount of time at this point. Actors, they might not get some actors back. I mean, that could be a big difficulty with this.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how this makes a May 2018 release date. I mean, it's Star Wars. It's not, it's effects heavy, I assume, unless it's like a bottle episode in the Millennium Falcon. In which case, this should be pretty easy. But I don't know.
And then also, it's just like, because it's not even just the new director has to come in and finish the material that was not originally finished. Presumably, like, they're going to have to redo stuff.
Yeah.
Like that, you can't just bring in another director and just have them like, okay, I'm going to put the fucking Band-Aid over, like, 3 weeks of shooting and that's it. Like,
that's
going to come out as, like, a fucking terrible movie.
Well, and that's not the movie they wanted, apparently,
exactly.
Because they fired Miller and Lord. So... what's going on? I mean, this is the most bizarre movie development I've heard of in years.
Yeah.
I mean, we make fun of DC for all this. At least they don't go into production.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they're just like, they're in talks and they're saying, okay, this person's going to direct and that person's like, no, fuck this, I'm going to go do this other movie. And it's like, it's not a good look, but it's understandable.
And even with Suicide Squad, which had a lot of retinkering in post and reshoots and stuff, David Ayer was the director through all of that.
Yeah.
They didn't bring someone else in. The Justice League thing that's going on, where Joss Whedon is reshooting a lot of it, that's, you know, specifically because Zack Snyder, his daughter died and all that. So, like, that's a personal tragedy, yeah. not a problem necessarily with the film. Again, all films have reshoots. So, like, yeah, I mean, even the most high-profile things I can think of in recent memory don't approach something like this. And for this to happen on Star Wars, I mean, also, Disney is just a well-oiled machine. You yeah. don't hear about this out of Disney. Disney can release bad movies sometimes, but they kind of just come and go, and they're able to bury that. Like, no one has seen the new Pirates of the Caribbean, and you can't prove to me that I'm wrong on that.
Yeah, no.
You can't prove to me that anyone has seen that movie or knows it exists.
Although, I mean, I can tell you that Davy Jones comes back at the end of that movie. Okay. And that sounds like that's supposed to be a joke, but according to Wikipedia, it's true.
Who knows? Yeah. No one's seen it. So yeah.
Fair point.
Like, these things just tend to go under the radar at that company. I mean, maybe more news has broke, but like, I am fascinated by this. The biggest question for me is, again, what director on earth would want this job? You know, I just, there's no upside to it.
David Lynch, he comes back. He's like, fuck it, I'm fresh off this Twin Peaks shit. I'm hot. I'm in it. Like, I'm going to right the wrongs of Dune by going in and finishing this other movie that these guys didn't finish.
I mean, the one thing, people were joking about this on Twitter, but I actually think it's a possibility, is Colin Trevorrow, who is directing Episode 9,
sure.
hasn't started yet. They really like him at Lucasfilm because of what he did on Jurassic World, I guess, which is a horrible movie, but whatever. Maybe you just get him to come in and do 6 weeks. And just, sure. he's already in the family. Finish that. I can see that's the most plausible thing I've heard. It, as crazy as the situation is, you know, whatever. Like, maybe. Yeah. Maybe Joss Whedon jumps to this one next as in yes. his new yeah. script doctor phase. Like, going back to his roots. I don't know. But, yeah, I was never, like, thinking this was a guarantee to be a good movie, but I was excited for it because of Miller and Lord. You take them away, and then you reveal this whole thing was a shit show. I'm terrified of this movie now.
I mean, yeah, now it just sounds like, it feels like, well, of course this happens when you try to make a fucking Han Solo prequel movie, because that's such a stupid fucking idea. Maybe yeah. even they couldn't make it work. I know.
Yeah, maybe it was actually an even worse idea than the Lego movie or a 21 Jump Street reboot. Yeah. yeah. So who knows? I mean, we'll keep an eye on this.
Yeah, I'm really excited just like for like a year or something from now when it can finally kind of come out what the fuck happened.
I know.
That's
because like we finally,
might be the most interesting thing of all.
Yeah, we did finally get the details on Rogue One, in part because that wasn't like people trying to murder each other. Yeah. And really that actually was an example of the process working right, because if you read about that, even if you didn't like Rogue One on the whole, what they improved was the third act, and everyone agreed that was the good part of that movie. Yeah. So that worked as it was supposed to. Maybe you could have given characters personalities somewhere in there. But
it would have been nice, but
yeah,
at least shit blew up real good at the end of that movie.
Absolutely. So who knows? Let's talk about another weird piece of news that just yeah. broke. Variety reported that Damon Lindelof, fresh off The Leftovers and its universally acclaimed third season, is developing a Watchmen series for HBO.
Never happening.
It's probably never happening, but let me finish my blurb. HBO apparently picked up the rights to Watchmen several years ago. They are a division of Time Warner that is within the Warner Brothers right. family for a variety of reasons. DC, blah, blah, blah. This has been coming in so much as HBO has been looking for someone to develop this. Damon Lindelof is under an overall development contract with Warner and Time Warner stuff, so that is what he's being put on now, I guess. My reaction when I saw that was, like, let's put aside, I think you're probably right, this will never happen.
It's never fucking happening.
Even
if it happens, I don't believe it.
No, it's probably never happening, but let's play in the world for a second where it's a possibility.
Okay, let's go to Fantasyland.
Yes. I find it weird for a number of reasons. I mean, The Leftovers is an amazing artistic accomplishment, and I think, to me, it's the show of the decade. It is one of the best things HBO has ever made, and that's saying something. It's one of the all-time TV shows. But it was not watched by many people. And Damon Lindelof is coming off 3 years of HBO bankrolling his Strange Arc project. And when you do that, sometimes you have to go and make something commercially successful again.
Okay, yeah.
Somehow Brian Fuller avoided that from Hannibal to American Gods. And I'm going to talk about Brian Fuller again in a second. But yeah, anyway. So I can see why Damon Lindelof was like, okay, something I do has to make money again so that I can then go back and make something sad again.
Yeah.
You know? And the thing is, and you guys know how much I love Damon Lindelof. Yeah. I started doing like TV blogging and stuff with Lost. I grew up with that show. I love that show. I love The Leftovers even more. He is one of my favorite people in Hollywood. He is the number one person on my list of people in that industry I would like to sit down and talk to. I love Damon Lindelof. he has no business doing Watchmen. That's a weird fit. I feel like he'd admit that's a weird fit. It just doesn't really make sense to me as a fit. Frankly, the only person I would be excited about doing another Watchmen adaptation would be the aforementioned Brian Fuller, because I could see him bringing the requisite homoeroticism to that material.
Sure.
And, like, he would get it in a way I think most Hollywood people don't get Watchmen. And then the third issue in all of this is, just shut up with Watchmen. We don't need it anymore. Yeah. You guys have killed that material to death.
Mm-hmm.
I have no doubt that someone could make a good TV show out of Watchmen, but I think that's also a world in which the Zack Snyder movie and the DC Comics and the other DC Comics and the other ripoffs of Watchmen don't exist.
Yeah, like Watchmen was an amazing thing in its moment in history. It's just very unfortunate that a lot of people took up Watchmen, kind of took a lot of the wrong messages from Watchmen and made a bunch of crap.
Yeah.
And so now then, in a world where then Watchmen comes back, now Watchmen, instead of feeling like subversive and interesting, it feels like it's just another one of these pieces of crap, like in a Dark Knight Returns style kind of thing.
And that's why I say, if you're going to hire anyone to do it, it has to be Brian Fuller, because that's exactly what you would have said about Hannibal Lecter
Sure. Before
he did it. And what you need is a genuinely subversive mind to do this genuinely subversive material and do it right. Damon Lindelof is many things. I don't think he would be subversive with this. I think, frankly, he would be reverent for it in much the same way Zack Snyder was. I think he'd get the material more. I think he'd understand the themes a little more. But I don't think we need another reverent adaptation of Watchmen.
Although here's an argument for Lindelof, as someone who has not seen The Leftovers but heard you talk about it a lot. You have talked to me a lot about how much penis there is in The Leftovers.
There is a lot.
And there's a lot of penis in Watchmen. And so I'm thinking maybe there's some sort of penis crossover in the Lindelof verse that he could take advantage of.
I need the article of just taking everyone from The Leftovers and casting them in Watchmen, because you could do it. Justin Theroux is Night Owl. Okay. Christopher Eccleston, he could voice Dr. Manhattan.
Okay.
I don't know.
No, not just voice him. You fucking paint that man blue.
Okay.
You paint his dick blue.
He's already.
And you throw him on that screen naked.
He showed his dong on The Leftovers. We can do that. I think Carrie Coon should probably just play every female role in it because she's that talented, but she could play the first Silk Spectre because you would have to do old age makeup, and
right.
She wore old age makeup extremely well in The Leftovers finale.
Okay.
So, yeah, we could go down the list, but like, that's the only fun that could come of this. Again, it's not going to happen, for one, because this is the kind of thing that's just, it's an early thing. He's probably going to write a script. He's probably going to look for people, and I think ultimately HBO is going to say, and we have Westworld.
Yeah, like, I think, like, Watchmen's hard material to do. It's, like, very limited, unless you want to add a lot of stuff to it, which is, like, a recipe for disaster anyways.
Exactly. You can either get one season out of it, or do one season and then just keep going. And I think Lindelof would not be the guy who would want to do that.
Yeah.
And I think if you got the kind of guy who would want to do that, it wouldn't be good in the first place.
Yeah, although, DC did several years ago, did that, like, series of before Watchmen spin-off comic book whatever, and apparently the Watchmen are coming up in like the DC multiverse fucking crossover blah 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 summer event in comic books. So Watchmen's a hot thing right now, I guess. I don't know.
It's just, I mean, it's a thing that sells well for DC, so
yeah.
But yeah, it's probably not going to happen.
It's not going to happen, and it shouldn't happen. And no. I'll be happy to see it not happen.
I want Damon Lindelof to just make another weird art project. That's all I want from these creators.
Leftovers 2.
Yes. More Leftovers. All right. Other pieces of news.
Okay.
Video game thing. IO Interactive, the studio that makes
Hitman,
they have announced they have achieved full independence
yes.
from Square Enix. And in even better news, they retained the Hitman IP, and so the story has a happy ending.
Yes, it is. It is basically the most positive outcome to the, like, Square Enix is a dick. They, like, basically divide, like, set off and said, like, hey, fuck off, IO. We're dissolving ourselves of you. We're divesting ourselves of you. You're going off. And nobody knew what that meant for Hitman, like, for a potential Hitman Season 2, which was, like, heavily rumored for about a year now, like, ever since, like, around the beginning of Season 1 that they were already working on Season 2. No one knew what happened to the IP. And then now, IO came out and said, we are fully independent. It reminded me a lot of when Bungie got out from under the hood of Microsoft and said, hey, we fulfilled our contract with those assholes. We're good. We're going to, like, we are an independent studio. We can do what we want. They signed a contract with Activision to do Destiny and all that stuff. And this feels like a similar attitude of, like, we used to be an independent studio. We were happy there. Then eventually, I think the like lineage was they got bought by Eidos, that then shortly got bought by Square Enix. So that's how they got under the Square Enix umbrella. And then now they're out free. You know, they have risen from the ashes or whatever. And
as we said,
like you said, retained the Hitman IP. So presumably are still working on a Hitman season 2.
Yeah, and as we said a few months ago or weeks ago when the news broke that Square Enix was dumping them to the curb, there have to be dozens of like publishers that would want that. Just because if you can't take what they did on Hitman Season 1 and build on that and get it popular, you're not good at your jobs. And I don't mean the developers, I mean the publishers.
Yeah, because it's Hitman Season 1 was my favorite game of 2016, which was a year that had a lot of really fucking good video games in it. And I'm so fucking happy that this has turned out like good.
And I'm surprised of two things.
Yeah.
I'm surprised on some level that they were able to keep the Hitman IP.
Yeah.
Because the only thing that Bungie story that's not the same is Bungie did not get Halo.
Oh, yeah.
In that
yeah.
divorce. Bungie left with what they could carry on their backs, pretty much.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that it happened this quickly. You would think Square Enix would at least like be dicks and sue them or something. Like that it would not be this quick to extricate all the legal stuff. So that's just, it's a good ending to the story. Nice of Square Enix not to be complete dicks about it, I guess.
Yeah.
And I hope they can find a publisher who will support them. And I'm sure there are many publishers out there who would be like, yes, we can make apples out of these.
And also on the back of this, IO have made the sort of the tutorial levels of Hitman Season 1 free. So people can just play those for free if you have not played Hitman. If you listen to this podcast and have not believed me raving about it, like, check out those tutorials and just play them for free and then buy the rest of the game because it's awesome.
I do not mean this as a slight on Hitman, which is a wonderful game. All the levels are wonderful. The tutorial might be my favorite section of it.
Sure.
So really play that. It's great even if you don't go on and play more.
Yeah, that's the right attitude is, like, get those for free, play the shit out of them, and then you will, if you, like, play a lot of the same level of Hitman, then you will understand why this thing was awesome, why it like was benefited by the episodic release structure, and then you can go off and play the rest of Hitman because it's fucking great.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Something else that's fucking great, Sean. Warner Archive, which is the division of Warner Brothers Home Video that puts out like manufactured on demand and limited run Blu-ray releases and DVD releases of like sort of obscure rare films in their catalog, have announced that they are making a Blu-ray release of Batman, Mask of the Phantasm.
The best Batman movie.
The animated film based on the animated series. It's coming out in 1 month on July 25th. Pre-orders went up about 30 minutes before we started recording.
It's about
$22, which is a fine price for a Warner Archive release. It'll be remastered in full high definition. It'll have both the theatrical 16:9 version and the open mat 4:3, which is actually not cropped. It's more animation top and bottom because that's how you would tend to do animation like that back in the day. This is awesome. We have talked about Mask of the Phantasm many times on this podcast. It is a phenomenal Batman movie. It's just a phenomenal superhero movie wherever you place it in the Batman canon. I might still put Dark Knight a little higher, but it's terrific either way. And the DVD of that movie looks like garbage.
Yeah.
Because it's from like the early 2000s.
It's a very old DVD.
It's a flipper disc with like two sides for the full screen and widescreen. And it doesn't even have
full screen movies.
Yep. And this is awesome. And I think in another way, like not just being able to see this movie in high definition and Blu-ray quality, which is great because the animation is wonderful. If this sells well, maybe they'll look at doing the animated series.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's the other thing is the way the animated series and the movie were done is they were animated on black paper to make it that dark, which is why the series looks so cool. It also makes it tremendously difficult to like remaster and make look good on like digital versions because it was very much done analog back in the day. And so the DVDs of the animated series and the movie don't look nearly as good as they should for a show of that pedigree.
Yeah.
And we'll at least get the movie, and I assume they'll have done a good job on this, and I'm excited to see it in decent quality. But then, you know, Warner Archive has released all the other Batman TV shows, like, since that, on that service, and those have a lot less cleanup work to do. But I do think if this has good reception, maybe they'll look at doing a season or something and, like, trying that out. And if it's an archive release, maybe there's the business there for it, because that is one series I would absolutely purchase again on Blu-ray. Because,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it deserves it.
It is and will always be the definitive Batman for me, so.
Absolutely, me too. And, you know, maybe when this comes out in July, we can watch it and do an episode on it, just because it's great.
Yes, I will always be up for doing more podcasts on Mask of the Phantasm.
It's great. Yeah, I'm excited to see this again. So, yeah, I have actually never bought from Warner Archive, but I like what they do, and now I finally have something that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
So it's great. All right, last thing in news is let's do some E3 follow-ups.
Okay.
Do you have any, I mean, there actually wasn't as much post E3 news as I thought there was going to be.
Yeah, like there were just, usually you have like a couple of things that kind of sneak out that are like, you know, smaller indie games or something that never made it onto a big press conference that make a splash on the show floor. And there wasn't a lot of that this year.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I don't know if we have much follow-up. I have one thing I want to talk about. But is there anything else like specific, Sean, or things that we learned about beyond like just more news about things we'd already seen that you wanted to mention?
I think like one thing that's like, I just want to give a shout out to there's two interviews with Phil Spencer that I think are really fucking awesome that people should check out if they're interested about the Xbox One X stuff and like the direction of Microsoft. Because Phil Spencer is like really great in interviews. He's a really interesting guy. There's the Giant Bomb E3 late night interview they did. That they've done that with him for like 3 years now, and it's like an hour long interview, but it's really great. It goes right by. That's just on the Giant Bomb YouTube channel, and people should check out that. Jack, check that out. If you don't have like an hour to watch that interview, there is a more sort of compressed kind of similar interview that's on Waypoint. That's like a 15-minute interview with Phil Spencer that covers similar talking points. And I just want to shout those out. Like, if you're interested in that stuff, go check out those interviews because they're really good. And it's really interesting to hear stuff about like talking about setting it at $500 because, of course, it was going to always be at $500, you fucking crazy people. I mean, Phil Spencer like literally said, you know, we price our products based on how much they cost in my manufacturer, not based on how much our competition is selling their stuff at, because that's how you fucking...
Right.
That's how business works. You know, there's a lot of talk about like how 4K TVs and stuff fit into the market now. Those are really cool.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Frankly, I'd rather they just air an interview with Phil Spencer instead of the Xbox presser.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Because...
get more out of it, honestly.
Because Phil is... You're right. He's a really interesting guy. I don't think he gets to be the best version of himself on that stage.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't get to be as in-depth. Mm-hmm. Which you can say for a lot of people at E3, but still. Yeah, so that was interesting. The thing I want to talk about...
Okay.
...is we gushed about Super Mario Odyssey last week.
Yeah.
But... after their like main show and they did the Treehouse stuff, in between Treehouse segments, they were playing the full version of the Super Mario Odyssey song. Okay. And this, of course, led to people getting a rip of the audio. And there are many YouTube versions of it you can listen to. And people have made lyrics versions of it. And the other night, because every couple of hours I feel the itch to go look at stuff from Mario Odyssey because I am so jazzed for this fucking game.
Sure.
I was watching the theme song just with lyrics so I could read along. That song, it might be Nintendo's greatest contribution to culture.
Okay, that's a significant claim. I always thought it was the Virtual Boy, but...
Yeah, no, it's a stupid claim and it's ridiculous, but you'll see what I mean. I want to read you some of these lyrics, Sean. They are amazing. I mean, you guys already heard some of the silly lyrics, like, you know, jump with me, grab coins with me, and things like that. Just the silly lyrics that are on the nose. It gets even better, because this song, it's a full 5-minute song. It's got, Jesus like, multiple Christ. Verses and stuff. And multiple, you know, it's got the chorus. And so it's a full written song. And I want to read some of this to you. So we'll start with like the simple stuff early on and then get into the craziness.
Okay. And we should point out, I do not know what the lyrics of the song are. I did not know that people had listened enough to like discover the full lyrical volume of this track.
Also, the producer of Mario Odyssey did a Reddit AMA. Where he confirmed that this song is in the game. It's not just for marketing.
Okay, good.
And it is sung by Pauline, the character from Donkey Kong, who is now the mayor of New Donk City.
Yes.
And has a jazz band.
Yes.
This is the greatest game ever. I haven't played it, but it is. All right. Here's a verse I love. Don't look back on the past. Say a word. I'll be there in a flash. You can say, my hat is off to you. That's just a great pun on the hat thing, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have the things like, you know... like I said, jump with me, grab coins with me, all that. But here's where I really sat up and took notice of these lyrics. And this is where the title of the song comes from. And if the dark clouds start to swirl, don't fear, don't shed a tear, because I'll be your one-up girl. And the title of the song is One Up Girl.
Okay.
I'll be your one-up girl.
Okay.
It gets a repeat later. I'll read you that in a second. In one of the verses, they have a line about, I'm pushing the switch. And I just can't help but think that's a reference to the Nintendo Switch.
Yeah, it probably is.
Yeah. And here's the rhyme. I'm pushing the Switch. Get ready for this. Oh, let's do the Odyssey. It's great. It's great.
I thought they were going to rhyme Switch with Bitch, and it was going to turn into a gangster rap song.
No. All right, here's the callback to our one-up girl thing. And if you find you're short on joy, don't fret. Just don't forget that you're still our one-up boy.
Okay.
Amazing. Amazing.
And that's a word for it, yes.
And here is another good one. So go and straighten out your cap. Let your toes begin to tap. This rhythm is a power shoe. I love that verse. It's so stupid.
What does it even mean? What is your rhythm is a power shoe? What is it? What is a fucking power shoe? Isn't a power shoe a power-up from the Sonic the Hedgehog games?
I don't know. All right. We're coming up on my favorite rhyme in all of this. All right. Don't worry. You're the superstar. No one else can make it this far. Put a comb through that stash. Now you've got panache. Stash with panache. It's amazing.
Who puts a comb in their stash?
I don't know, but when they do, they've got panache.
Sure, I guess.
So I just wanted to read some choice lyrics from that song, I'll Be Your One-Up Girl. That's amazing.
That's a thing.
Someone pointed this out on, I think it might have been the YouTube comments on that video I was watching somewhere, that sounds like if Mario were a Disney afternoon show in the early 90s, that would be its theme song.
Sure,
like Chippendales or DuckTales or something like that. And I can totally see that.
Yeah.
I love it. Nintendo, whatever drugs you're taking to make Mario Odyssey, I want some.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're on those one-up shrooms to make this one-up girl.
All right, you want to do some spoiler talk?
Let's get into some spoilers.
Let's start with Wonder Woman, just because it's been out the longest. It's been out for like a month.
Wonder Woman.
Not a full month. It's 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah. I think it just finished its third weekend. So yeah, you guys know what I thought. I think it's a really damn good superhero movie. You can read my review on jonathanlack.com and might have already. So you know what I thought. Sean, what did you think of Wonder Woman? And we'll have spoilers from here on out.
Yes. So yeah, total full-on spoiler discussions. I like it a lot. I don't think I'm not as positive on it as you are and as a lot of people are. That like I... There are some ways I'm kind of conflicted about parts of the movie that I think Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman, fantastic. You know, Chris Pine as Steve Trevor, fantastic. Like, they have incredible chemistry. Like, the acting there is great. The writing is great. There's a lot of really great, warm, fun moments. And that is one of those things that really sets it apart from the other DC films in a way that, like, kind of highlights even more how just, like, debilitated those movies are by their like strict adherence to this like stupid fucking tone.
Wonder Woman feels like a movie made by humans for humans.
Yeah. But at the same time, it does have a certain DC-ness to it that it does not feel like just like a Marvel movie. Like it has, I think part of that comes from like the nature of Wonder Woman as a very DC character, because she is, I mean, in this movie they give her the Zeus background, so she is literally a demigod, and so there's some of that makes her, you know, because you can make some obvious comparisons with this and Captain America the First Avenger, which is set in World War II. This is World War I, but they have similarities. But Wonder Woman has this sort of like remove and this extreme level of power that like Captain America does not have, that makes it feel a lot more like DC than Marvel to me. So it's like it has the lighter tone, but it does not just feel like they decided to make a movie entirely in the Marvel mode. And I like that about it, that it definitely feels distinct. And so all that stuff is really good. So some of my problems with the movie come in with, I think, while they have like a lot of good ideas in how to use the World War I setting, I think ultimately they did not sort of execute on that the way they needed to. And I think it probably would have been smarter for them to do World War II instead of World War I. Because that is, World War II was the original setting for the Wonder Woman origin story, because that was, you know, that was when those comics were originally made. And I think they pay a lot of good lip service, and there's a lot of dialogue telling you about the complexities of World War I and about how there's like, oh, there's no real heroes, there's no like right side, it's everyone's fault, like all this stuff. They say that, but I don't think the sort of the text of the movie and like what you really see the characters doing fully backs up that argument. And I think they present an overly simplistic perspective on World War I at the end of the day. I think they over-villainize the Germans. They over-glorify the British and the Allies side. And I don't think they ever fully convinced me that they really were embracing the kind of like murkiness that is inherent with World War I. But at the same time, like, I also don't know if that's necessarily the movie they should make, because I don't know how you make a PG-13 movie about that. And I don't know how you come out of a superhero movie about World War I that is really more honest about World War I and feel super pumped up about that. You know, like, that's a like World War One's super fucked up. Like, super, super, super fucked up in some very specific ways that make it a hard thing to tackle in a story. And I think, ultimately, like, they just were not really equipped to fully deal with that, and it really debilitates some of the sort of the key scenes in the movie around the middle and in the climax for me.
Okay.
And then other problems, I think, like, ultimately, just, like, the whole climactic part of the movie is pretty messy. I think that's, like, one of the big complaints that a lot of people have about it. Like, I don't think Ares is never done super well. I think, like, there's a lot of stuff about how rushed some of the revelations are, like, really compressed in the ending, where I think, like, Wonder Woman really needs to come to the conclusion that Ares is not the core problem here much earlier, like, not much, much earlier in the movie, but before she has to, like, be railroaded immediately into the final conflict, because it's, like, she has to, like, sort of learn the moral of the movie, and, like, right at the end, right when fighting the villain, well, and it's, like, this is all compressed in such a way that, like, it's very hard to sort of take a step back and make sense of what the movie's really trying to say.
It's interesting, because I think the third act has some just utterly incredible stuff in it, and, like, the stuff with Steve Trevor at the end, and her, and I think how they tie all that together thematically saves all of that for me. But I see what you mean, and I do think, like, in particular, I think Ares in this movie works wonderfully as a theme until you meet him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting issue to have, because I think my favorite thing about this movie is the arc they wrote for Diana. And I think I agree there are complexities with World War One where I don't think you can ever do it perfectly in this setting at all. I think they did a very good job with it in a lot of different ways, even if, yeah, I don't think they did it perfectly, because I don't frankly think you can in this setting. But, like, I think Diana's arc is so fascinating to me in this movie, because it is almost like a call and response against the problems of Man of Steel, or Batman v Superman, or The Amazing Spider-Man, or any of these recent superhero origin stories that are where the superhero just becomes the hero completely out of circumstance, and they have no proactivity whatsoever. Right. It's completely reactive. And those aren't heroes. Those are just bystanders who weren't cowards in the moment, right? Like, that's a weird distinction, you know? And so, with Wonder Woman, the whole story is about this woman who really has these powers and wants to help the world. She has this kind of belief system, and she wants to go out and help people. And I think the scene that is most powerful in the entire movie, for a lot of people, me included, is when she's in the trenches with Steve and the people, and it's, you know, this talk about how we need to get to that other battalion, but there's no way we can do this. And she is so kind of sure of this belief system she has that she gets up, and that is the moment where we first see her in costume and everything, climbing out of the trenches and making that run. It's just a fantastic scene, and I think it's, you know, that's the moment where she becomes quote-unquote Wonder Woman in this movie. And if you compare that to similar moments in, like, Amazing Spider-Man or Man of Steel, it has so much more impact because it is about that character's proactivity.
Yeah.
And the Ares character is so key to that because, you know, she was raised on Themyscira. She has this very mythological view of the world. She thinks that that humans basically have no evil agency, and it's just Ares the entire time. And I think that's a fascinating story arc because it's about, I don't think it's about this character getting all hope beaten out of her. It's about this character maturing in her views on the world, and I really like that as a story arc. And I think, as I was saying, it works all the way up to the point where you meet Ares, and then I don't think, like, this was an inherent mistake where you couldn't handle it well. But I think there's that scene, you know, where she kills the German leader, the Hydra guy. that's really what those characters are.
Yeah.
She kills the Hydra guy, and she thinks that was Ares, and it turns out it's not. And I think you're exactly right. There needed to be at least one more scene or one more choice or something if they wanted to bring in Ares at the end. She had to already have had that realization before she comes face to face with him. And as you say, it means a lot of her final arc stuff has to happen during the climax. And some of that I find impressive. I think the way they tie in Steve Trevor's sacrifice and what she hears from him and how she uses that to beat Ares, all of that I think is handled very well. But then some of the stuff in terms of her actual, like, philosophical conversation with Ares, it's a little, as you say, too rushed in that moment.
Yeah, it's just,
especially because it's a movie that breathes really well for most of its runtime, and I think this is a superhero film that handles pace better than, like, 90% of them.
Sure, yeah. So, I agree with that for most of the movie, but it is, like, she just needed to have a moment where she actually has to, like, confront her naivety up to that point, like, realize, like, zoom out and realize, like, you don't understand the full scope of what's going on here. Because of course you can't. Like, there's no way you would ever be able to. Because nobody understands the full scope of what's going on in World War One. But she has this very closed, naive mindset because of where she comes from. And she really needs this moment of confronting that head on, having, I think, like, because they have these narrative steps in there of, like, having a falling out with Steve Trevor and then having to reconcile that. And, like, there are things there that are built there that are, like, you know, the sort of screenplay 101, like, that's how that plot kind of is set up to go things that they do kind of do, but they don't put enough emphasis on those narrative beats at the end because it just feels like it needs to rush to this conclusion because, you know, the movie is already kind of long. I think it doesn't feel super long, but it's like it is a decent length. And so it's like, I think they just ran into a weird issue with the pacing near the end on how to wrap up these themes because they are pretty big and they're very meaty. And I just think the movie doesn't know quite what to do with them at the end.
But that's a great discussion to be having.
Sure.
Just like, let's take a step back and compare that to a Batman v Superman or Suicide Squad discussion.
I mean, yes, if you're comparing it to the fucking dregs of the barrel, is like not even in that barrel.
Or even a lot of other, like, you know, lesser superhero movies.
Sure.
It's, we're having this discussion because it's reaching for something that I think a lot of genre films in this genre would not reach for.
Sure, yeah.
And I think that's great, you know? And I think those are discussions worth having, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the film brings up interesting ideas throughout on those things. It, you know, it does not... This is not a movie that pays lip service to its ideas. Even if it doesn't fully pay through on those, it is so actively trying on all of that.
Sure.
And I think it is acting with such intelligence and grace in a lot of what it does that it makes it interesting to talk about. It doesn't make it like, I'm angry about this problem. It's, I'm critically interested in this.
Sure, yeah.
And I think that's an important distinction to have. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the other thing I would say about the thing at the end with Eris is, I think, if I would not have as much of a problem with this in a world where Batman v Superman, Man of Steel, and Suicide Squad don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I want to live in that world. But anyway,
we could have lived in that world if only we had taken that right turn, but we turned left.
No, if we could live in that world. But those movies all have such an utter glorification of destruction and violence and big CGI barf that when you see the Eris scene in this, for me, it's like, it's actually pretty good CGI barf as these things go.
Sure.
Like, Eris is an interesting, like, character design. They really go for it. I think they meld some of the different parts of that battle well. It's an overall well-done version of something I don't like all that much. But there's still that element of, like, that's the only moment of the movie where I felt the presence of, like, other DC films. Of, like, that's the kind of action this movie didn't seem interested in.
Yeah.
And I do get you have to have the moment where Wonder Woman can fully show off her powers. I just wonder if you could have done it in a way that felt more germane to this movie and not, here's where we spent $50 million on CGI and blowing stuff up.
Yeah, it definitely has this, like, Batman v Superman sort of flashback for me of, like, everything I'm looking at is just totally digital. It's like, the movie, which, like, feels really real and lived in and, like, personal and human for all of it. And then at the very end, it's like, everything I'm looking at is so artificial. It's so fake. It's, like, just... It's a very jarring turn that I do, on the one hand, I do kind of get, again, going back to, like, DC superheroes tend to be way more powerful than your average Marvel superhero. Like, Captain America is a dude who's kind of stronger than normal, kind of faster than normal, is pretty smart, and has a really nice shield, and that's it. Wonder Woman is super strong, she can fly, she's super fast, she has a magic lasso, she has invulnerable bracelets that fucking reflect energy and bullets, like, she has an invisible airplane that I was hoping that would be, like, the post-credits scene would be, like, the Amazonians back on Themyscira, like, pulling out Steve Trevor's plane from the ocean and turning it into an invisible airplane with their bullshit Amazon magic. Unfortunately, they don't really do that. But
that would be amazing.
Yeah, but Wonder Woman is just an extremely powerful character, and to try to get that across, you obviously need, like, a huge amount of digital effects to really, like, make that feel real, I guess, to, like, to communicate that to the audience.
But it is something impressive about all the other action scenes.
Yeah.
Very much in a way of, like, Superman 78, which I actually think is a really good touchstone for talking about.
Sure.
People bring that up a lot with Wonder Woman. I think it's not a bad comparison in a lot of different ways. In part that Superman is also a character who's very difficult to show his powers on screen.
Yeah.
And I think Wonder Woman, for most of its runtime, takes an almost Christopher Reeve Superman approach to that, which is, it's situational, it's about other characters reacting to her, it's about Gal Gadot's performance, and, like, the choreography and the effects are really good, but they're secondary to that. And I think they do a really good job with that. And again, I do understand the instinct of, like, we can do this. It's the year 2017. I just think, you know, maybe there's a way to do that. And maybe it's just letting some of those scenes breathe more. And maybe Eris could be set up in different interesting ways. I don't... Again, he's set up as a theme more than he is a character.
Yeah.
Hey, it's... Look, I will never not enjoy David Thewlis as an actor, especially when they put him in a ridiculous costume and have him saying these lines. That was kind of awesome.
I mean, but, dude, the part where they... Because it's like, whatever, like, sure, Ares, the Greek god of war, takes the form of a British imperialist. Like, I can get behind that, even if I don't think the movie fully understands what it's trying to do with that. I can get behind that idea. The part that is the most insane is when you get the flashback to, like, Greek mythological times, and it's still that dude with his British-ass fucking imperialist mustache. You're like, oh, wait, so this is just... Ares just happens to look like a classic British imperialist. He didn't shapeshift into one. That's just the way he's always looked. That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, no. And, you know, again, what separates this from a lot of other CGI fests is you care about the character at the center of it.
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
You go into that. Like, compare how you view Gal Gadot in Batman v Superman to how, at the end of that movie, to how you view her in this. And I was like, that's a character.
Yeah.
That's a performance. They gave her things to do. You know, it's...
Yeah, it's like, at least when she was on screen at the last action scene, like, I paid attention to it. For, like, the last 30 minutes of Batman v Superman, my eyes completely glazed over in a way that, like... Before that moment, I don't think I ever really understood what the phrase "your eyes glazed over" really meant, because it never happened to me. And then they're all fighting fucking Apocalypse, or not Apocalypse,
Doomsday.
Doomsday at the end. You can see how I get that name mixed
same
up.
Thing.
Huh? Yeah, Doomsday at the end of Batman v Superman. I was like, I literally don't know what's happening, because I feel like my brain is telling my eyes not to look at this anymore because of how stupid it is.
No, Patty Jenkins is a more interesting director than Zack Snyder.
I would
I'll
agree
just with go
that.
With that.
Yeah.
I mean, let's talk about that for a second.
Okay.
It's a beautifully directed movie.
Yes. Yeah.
It is outstandingly directed. I love the pace of this thing. I love that for the first 2 hours or so, it is leisurely in how it moves. And I mean that in the best way possible,
yeah.
That scenes breathe. Characters get to emote. I love Patty Jenkins, I think, shoots these characters in a way you don't get in a lot of genre films, where so much of... Like, Gal Gadot gives, for large parts of this movie, a fairly nonverbal performance.
Mm-hmm.
And what allows that to work is, A, she's really, really good in this role, but also Patty Jenkins shoots her in a way where, you know, a lot of the story is told through close-ups and reaction shots as we watch her react to the world. And I think Gal Gadot, what makes her so great in this movie is she has such... an expressive face, where this is a character who kind of can't help but wear her emotions on her sleeves.
Yeah.
And when you watch her realize what her powers are, or see, you know, war for the first time, or interact with Steve Trevor, she gives such interesting, nuanced, lived-in reactions to these things, and Patty Jenkins is there to let those things breathe, and I love that. Like, and it shows me why I don't think I liked the trailers for this movie, because I don't think you can cut a good trailer for a movie like this.
Sure, yeah.
I think it's too laid back in a lot of ways. Like, the Steve Trevor Wonder Woman dynamic looked kind of hacky in the trailers to me. And then you watch it at length and it's like, well, that's because if you just cut out one one-liner, it's going to look like that. But look at that scene on the boat where it's just them talking for like 5
yeah.
minutes. That is not the version of that scene I would ever predict out of Hollywood. It is not, or even the scene where he's naked coming out of the thing in Themyscira. It's
sure.
not dick jokes. It's not like, oh, she's discovering sex for the first time. It's all so much more complicated and nuanced than that. I think their vision of masculinity with Steve Trevor is far more interesting than you get in a lot of these movies. And what makes Steve Trevor a great character isn't that he's the male version of the, you know, typical female lead or anything.
Right.
It's that they took the co-star of a superhero movie and wrote him better than most superhero co-stars are written.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to, you know? And I think their relationship is so well considered through the movie. Yeah, and you know, we talked about Gal Gadot. Chris Pine came to play on this one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is the best I've seen him. Like I like him in the Star Trek movies and stuff. I've liked him in things,
I was
but
ask,
he's really good in this.
Have you seen last year's film, Hell or High Water?
No, I haven't.
You should watch it. You'd love it. It's a great modern American Western. It's also got Jeff Bridges doing
right.
full-on True Grit voice.
Okay, that's good.
Which is great. And that was a revelation for me on Chris Pine, because he's magnificent in that movie. He should have gotten an Oscar nomination. He's just fantastic. And I liked him in Star Trek too, and I think he's great in those. I just didn't know he had that in him.
Mm-hmm.
The Chris Pine in this movie is not Star Trek Chris Pine. It's Hell or High Water Chris Pine. And that fascinates me, because that is both him and Gal Gadot, I think, get to give human lived-in performances in ways they don't have the sheen of like movie star stuff you see in a lot of superhero movies. And I'm not putting down other, you know, superhero roles, but this is not Robert Downey Jr. or Chris Hemsworth doing this kind of larger than life thing. Even though Gal Gadot is playing a character very much larger than life, it feels like such a small, kind of nuanced, beautiful, lived-in performance. And I think that's a unique thing about that this movie to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. One thing I will say on that point, though, that like kind of bothered me at some point in the movie, it's not like specific to the Steve Trevor character, it's like a larger thing in the movie, is like I get that like at some point you're going to, particularly because of the setting, like you have to comment on, you know, like Wonder Woman's a woman and she's very attractive, but like there, I think there's just like a handful of lines too many in this movie of like dudes just going like basically saying the equivalent of like, man, you're really hot to Wonder Woman. It's like you can maybe ease off on that a little bit because it felt like a, just like a tad too much, you know. It's like I get it's some of that is necessary. It's like you don't need to like literally every fucking scene, like whenever she meets a new guy, that is always that guy's reaction. I feel like that gets a bit tedious.
I totally understand that, but I will say, beyond those like initial interactions, I thought they consistently found fascinating ways for her to interact with characters.
Sure.
Like the entire team that she fights with, like Steve Trevor's team.
Yeah.
Kind of like basically the equivalents of the Howling Commandos in Captain America.
Yeah.
I thought all of those characters were really good. They like read as characters much more deeply than I thought those kind of characters would. Like I remember those characters more than I do the Howling Commandos and Captain America. I think they give them more time to breathe and develop, and that there are those just nice scenes like by the campfire or in that town after they rescue it where the characters are just hanging out, and you get, you know, you have the Native American character has that great line about, you know, his people stole the land from my people, yeah, or something like that. And you have the other guy who has PTSD, and you have Steve Trevor who's dealing with his own shit. And I like that if the initial things Wonder Woman encounters with these characters is, you know, just mild, like, objectification, it becomes more like she is seeing different sides of masculinity as the film goes along.
Sure.
And I like how all of that is broken down. And that Steve Trevor at no point in the movie becomes, like, perfect on this thing either. Like, he is pretty constantly, like, underestimating Wonder Woman and saying, no, stay here, or something like that. And sometimes he's right, sometimes he's wrong. Yeah. But I think that's also interesting that these relationships develop in ways where, you know, the men are not perfect, but they also are not, you know, caricatures of, you know, frankly, how this movie would have been written 10, 20 years ago.
Right,
with
yeah.
those characters. So I just thought all the character interactions were very well considered and the performances were so sharp. And again, the movie gives these scenes time to breathe. I think one of the scenes that just blew me away is after the battle in that town, which is a great action scene. The thing, you know, it's an extension of that scene in the trenches. The scene with Wonder Woman and Steve in the, like, hotel room, or not the hotel room, but the inn room.
Right.
Where they wind up, you know, probably having sex that night.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful scene. It's a quiet scene. It's not at all how I've seen that kind of sequence done before. And I'm saying that a lot because there are a lot of scenes in this movie where, by virtue of what it is, it gets to do and executes on these very well kinds of scenes we haven't seen in these films before.
Yeah.
And I think that's a pleasure to watch.
At the same time, like, I don't know if I really needed or wanted the Steve Trevor Diana like relationship to become explicitly romantic. Like, I thought that was like, I liked them being friends. I thought that worked better. It's part of it comes with like my kind of biases from my other experiences with the Wonder Woman characters. I just don't like the Wonder Woman Steve Trevor romance. I've never thought it quite worked. I've always liked them more as friends, and so it's like I think there's something about Wonder Woman that I think like pigeonholing her into like a heterosexual romance just always feels kind of off to me. And so I just feel like that scene's not really needed in this movie, and I would have
preferred
if it stayed platonic.
I can totally understand that. I thought it was just done very well. Like,
sure,
it felt like a very mature adult thing that happened between the two of them. And they were, you know, they moved through those scenes as adults negotiating space between each other.
Sure.
And again, that's just not something you see in these movies. Especially, like, there has been a trend of, you know, romance was a big deal in superhero movies in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And it's fallen off.
It's just something that, like, every superhero movie needed one, whether they needed one or not.
And sometimes it was done very well, and sometimes it was done very poorly. But I think we're in a point now where, like, if it's done, I honestly oftentimes just wish, like, just ignore it. Because your heart is so clearly not in this. Like, I love the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. James Gunn has no idea what he's doing with the Star-Lord Gamora thing. It's like one area of those movies that does not feel confident. And I at least felt like if Wonder Woman was going to go to that place, they had scenes that were written that did the legwork.
Sure, yeah.
You know?
Like, it definitely does not feel like it was just thrown in there haphazardly because it needed to be in there.
Frankly, again, like Superman 78, where the romance is really cheesy in that movie, and it's not cheesy in this, but it's cheesy in Superman 78, but I also feel the earnestness.
Oh, yeah, like, I mean, that's like a huge part of that movie. That's,
yes,
like, that's like half of what the movie is.
Sure, and that's not nearly as much of what Wonder Woman is, but I can just see that same kind of, like, I think there was an earnest belief among the people making this movie that this was important. And you can disagree or disagree whether it should have been in there, but I like that they felt like they were coming to play with these things, not we're checking off a box on the superhero checklist.
I mean, yes, it is definitely a much better done romance than most superhero movie romances. Like, they tend to be complete afterthoughts, and I'm very happy that Marvel has moved into a space where they don't have to shove that into literally every single movie they make. It is in a lot of the movies they make still, but it is not required. There was a time where it felt like that was like in the contract with the director. Yeah. Like, you have to make sure.
Oh, if you want to see examples of where this has sunk movies, watch either Hulk film.
Yeah.
Either one. Sunk both of them. Well, it's one of the many things that sunk both of them.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyway. So, what else to talk about here? The Amazonian culture in, like, the first third.
Sure, yeah.
That's an awesome opening to the movie.
Yeah.
Again, I just love that we see scenes play at length there. We see kind of how Diana views the world. She just feels so much like a motivated character by the time she leaves that island. And I love, like, just the, like, kind of childish giddiness Gal Gadot brings to it when she's, like, she's so excited to have the shield and the sword and be going out in the world and everything. She doesn't have a shield. I'm sorry. You know what I mean?
I think she does at some point. I think she does.
I don't remember if she gets it on the island or not. I love their commitment to doing the Lasso of Truth.
Yeah, yes. It is needed. I like the Lasso of Truth. I get people think it's cheesy. Fuck that. It's cool.
They did it really well here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, introducing it with the interrogation of Steve Trevor, which allows you to have Steve Trevor look at it as this weird thing, kind of has our eyes on it. Great.
Yeah. Not enough bondage in the movie, though. Like, honestly... Like, but honestly, seriously, because that was that's a huge part of, like, the DNA of Wonder Woman in her inception. That is why the Lasso of Truth is a thing. There should have been more bondage. If they're going to put the Lasso of Truth in there, you know, maybe in the director's cut, we'll get, like, the explicit, like, NC-17 style Steve Trevor Wonder Woman sex scene where you've, like, Steve fully comes to understand what the Amazonians expect in the bedroom.
I just want to go on record saying I disagree with this, and I'm okay that they didn't do that in the movie.
I was just saying, you're going to put the Lasso of Truth. I thought they I'm usually not super into the thing of, like, movies, kind of superhero movies, being embarrassed of their own fiction and, like, trying to hide it. I thought they probably made the right choice in not just calling it the Lasso of Truth. They gave it some, like, weird Greek name that's probably been used in the comics at some point.
Yeah, no, it's the kind of thing where we get to call it that, and it's fun, but yes, I think the way this movie is written, you couldn't just throw that in there.
Also, on that note, like, they never specifically call her Wonder Woman in the whole movie, which is, like, I'm fine with, but...
I don't know you would in this script.
Yeah, it's hard, because it's like, I do not want the token scene where someone just goes, like, man, you're wonderful, woman, you're some sort of Wonder Woman. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? But I also, like, I like it when comic book movies can just call their superhero character by their superhero name and not think it's, like, weird, but hopefully that's something they can just do in the sequels, because I think this being a period piece makes it harder to pull off.
Yeah. I love the whole ending of the movie. Like, whatever issues you have with the third act, I like how it kind of wraps up and they go back home. And you know, the first scene, because it's got this brief kind of bookend thing where you have, you know, Wonder Woman in the Louvre. And I like her. She's got this setup in the Louvre where she's got all her artifacts and stuff. And that's kind of cool. And at first I thought, like, oh, we've got a Wayne tie-in. I don't know if I need this. But I really liked how it came back around. And it's her remembering and her little note to Bruce about thank you for bringing him back to me and all that. That was a really nice touch. And I thought that made the, you know, the whatever. The in-media rest kind of thing they did worth it.
Sure,
so, yeah. And again, it's very brief. And I just love how thoroughly unconnected to the other DC movies this is, because you can totally just take this movie on its own and never need any of the others, and that's great.
Yes, yeah.
But it also reminded me of, like, if Zack Snyder and company can actually lean into it on Justice League, I do like the idea of the friendship intimated between Wonder Woman and Bruce Wayne.
Sure.
And I like it more here, because you actually don't see Murder Batman, but maybe they can do something with that. I don't know. This movie hasn't really done anything to make me hopeful for Justice League.
No.
But who knows?
I mean, as I was telling you before we started the podcast, that, like, it almost makes me more trepidatious because we've seen how the Wonder Woman as a character can be done well, And so if she's done poorly again, it's like going to be that much worse by contrast.
Because, you know, I get a lot of why people said, like, oh, Wonder Woman's the best part of Batman v Superman. She's the only person who smiles in that movie.
Yeah.
I get it. Gal Gadot is a very magnetic screen presence.
And she's the most excised from the bullshit of that film.
Sure. Well, she's the one who clicks through the email attachments and watches the videos.
Yeah, but that's also kind of the most, like, even if those scenes are utterly unnecessary to the movie, the fact that they are that unnecessary to the movie means they're so removed psychologically from the movie that they're kind of, in some ways, the best part of the movie.
Kind of. But what I was going to say is, my problem with how Snyder used Wonder Woman in that film is she's just there for a series of poses.
Mm-hmm.
And look, he has that problem with all of his characters, but he also allows his male characters to talk and things like that. And I do worry about her kind of falling into that same thing with Justice League. And we'll see.
Hopefully that now that we know her backstory, like, they will avoid on trying to fall back on the, oh, she's like this enigmatic, exotic woman thing, that it felt like that was what her role in BVS was.
Yeah. Who knows? What I really want is I want them to sign Patty Jenkins on for a sequel.
Yeah.
And get that, because even if we have, you know, some quibbles with the movie, it's really darn good.
Yeah.
It's, I think, one of the best and most exciting superhero, you know, events in years. And I want more of this. I want to see what they can do with this character moving forward.
What I'm curious about with, like, a potential sequel, which I'm sure they're going to make a sequel with how well this movie has done, both, like, commercially and then vitally for WB, fucking critically. Like, it's the first one they've made since, like, The Dark Knight that has just been, like, everyone likes this movie. Like, what do you do with the sequel? Because it's, like, that's one of the tricky things about making it the first movie a period piece is, do you make the second movie another, like, you, like, set it in the 60s or something, or do you just bring it up, like, update it all the way to modern day, like, Justice League, whatever, and just, like, it makes it hard to envision exactly, like, what kind of genre Wonder Woman 2 is going to fit into specifically, because this one gets to have the period piece stuff that gives it a certain kind of structure that sets it apart. Like, it sort of puts it in a box with Captain America, but that is a box of two movies of superhero period pieces.
Right.
So, like, I'm really curious what they would do with a sequel.
I have no idea, but, you know, I trust the people who made this specific movie.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Patty Jenkins is such an interesting, fresh voice for this genre. She's been around, you know, directing stuff before, but, like, yeah, this doesn't feel like any other superhero movie out there. And yes, it absolutely has been cool and inspiring to see this movie come out and A, be really good.
Yeah.
B, make the money it's making. And C, I think have the impact on people it's having.
It's
inspiring. It's really cool.
I mean, there's kind of two things to talk about with the movie is, like, the movie just in and of itself, like, in a bucket or whatever. And then there's, like, the movie in its cultural context in this moment right now. And, like, that is super important. And I think, like, what Wonder Woman is in this movie is really powerful. And, like, the sort of the symbol she gets to be, like, for us in the real world outside of just the context of the movie is really important. And then also, like you said, the fact that this movie, like, finally, it turns out when you give the same kind of, like, you know, backing and marketing and everything behind a superhero movie that just happens to be directed by a woman, it gets similar sort of results from that kind of backing from a superhero movie directed by a man. Like, you're going to be able to make fucking money on it, you know?
You could argue better than a lot of the ones made by
But, like, regardless of, like, whatever the critical reception is, I just mean, like, commercially,
right,
it's going to fucking make superhero movie money. Because you haven't just fucking send it out to die like Catwoman, you know?
This was the whole thesis of my review, is that we, you know, culturally, because we have not let women into this party, asked this movie to be great. Like, all things women have to do when breaking through a glass ceiling, even if it's something as silly as a superhero movie, they have to be really good at it, sadly. There's, you know, because the double standard is so high, and this movie broke through that double standard, you know, perfectly, I think.
Yeah.
And it's great, and what that excites me about most is the doors it has opened, hopefully. Unless the studios are even more sexist than we thought.
Yeah.
But, like, I want to see the generation of movies that happens because of Wonder Woman. I want to see all the other, not just female-led superhero movies directed by women, I want to see them start letting women direct male superhero movies.
Sure.
And act, you know, and other just movies. Just let women into the fucking clubhouse, because there are so many voices we don't get to hear from.
Yeah.
And when you see one of these movies on that stage and you're like, yes, this is not the same thing we've seen in theaters 100 times. Even if you're someone like us who genuinely likes these movies or generally likes these films, it's so exciting. And I love that element of it.
Yeah, no, it's just, it's important. Because, again, like, kind of like you said, there's a possibility that the studios will still, like, be as sexist as they've been. But at least now, they don't have any fucking excuse. They can't make some bullshit argument about, like, well, look at this as, like, what, female superhero movies never make any money. The fucking movies directed by women never make any money. It's like, blah, 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 blah. It's like, fuck off, you, it's like, everyone on the planet can look at all of, like, look at your fucking list of movies and tell you why these movies did not make money, and none of those reasons have anything to do with it being a female character or directed by a woman. Yeah. It's like, the fact that you don't have some sort of bullshit excuse to go back on is important in and of itself.
It's very important, yes. And hey, they will always find stupid bullshit excuses. Patty Jenkins herself, for some reason, was in movie director prison for years after making Monster, which won multiple Oscars, mm-hmm. including launching Charlize Theron's career. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
But now she did this, and that's great, and I look forward to a long and awesome career from her and everyone involved with this movie. Again, Gal Gadot was really good in this.
She's very good.
That is a fucking movie,
like,
star performance.
She was good in Batman v Superman, but she wasn't obviously given much to do in that movie, and so it's like, I did not expect her to be this good.
And she's in a lot of the Fast and Furious movies, and she's fun in those, but that's, you know, you don't exactly get to flex your muscles as an actor in
sure,
those films.
Yeah.
Especially if you're not, like, the main character. So, yeah, no, it's cool. Wonder Woman is good. Let's talk about someone else.
I know, before we move on, I hate that we had, like, a really good segue and everything and wrapped up that discussion, but I don't want to move on from it before talking about the World War One stuff, because we didn't really get into that much. And okay. For me, it is my biggest problem with the movie, because I think it severely impacted my enjoyment of what I think is, like, kind of the most critical scene of the movie, and you've kind of talked about it a little bit, which is the trench scene in the middle of the film, which is, like, it's a scene that, like, on its own, I think is fantastic. Like, it's a really well-choreographed action scene. I think it's really spectacular in how it shows off Wonder Woman in her full costume for the first time. Like, all that stuff is great. I think the problem I have with that scene, though, and it's similar stuff that they do that kind of comes up again at the end, where I feel like they don't fully kind of drive the World War One stuff home the way they really, like, need to, or are telling you they're trying to, is that World War One, and this is the thing that the movie tells you, but it never, I feel like, fully sort of, like, believes in and makes the argument for. World War One is a war where there are no good guys and there are no bad guys. Like, there are some people that were obviously, like, discussing horrible war criminals on some sides of, like, in all the different armies. There are some people that were, like, trying to make the best of, like, a, like, horrific situation that no one can get out of in all the armies. Like, I don't mean there's no good guys and bad guys in the terms of, like, the individuals fighting in the war, but I mean, there was no good side to be on in World War One. World War One was a war that happened mostly by accident. It happened because there were secret alliances being made between all these different countries. It happened largely because it was, like, basically the world paying the price for all the sins of, like, imperialism and colonialism we committed in the 19th century and over the course of the 19th century. And so it was a war where it was largely about these big imperialist powers butting heads against each other, and these imperialist powers that had subjected so many different parts of the world under their rule and authority, that then all those parts of the world get dragged into the conflict as well. And I think, like, the movie tries to kind of say that to you, and Steve Trevor kind of tries to say that to the audience at the end of the movie, where he says, it's everyone's fault, we're all bad, it's all wrong. But I feel like the whole time the movie is really showing you that the British are the good guys and the Germans are the bad guys, and that's not true. Like, that's just not true. And so when Wonder Woman comes out triumphantly from the trenches and charges across the battlefield and goes and kills a bunch of German soldiers and helps Steve Trevor and everyone else charge and kill a bunch of German soldiers, it legitimately made me sick to my stomach, because she was murdering a bunch of terrified, scared, sick, famished, like, young men that are, like, some of, like, the youngest of which would be 10 years younger than we are, stuck in these fucking trenches, who did not want to be there, that most of their friends had already died from sickness, from trench foot, they were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, just the exact same way that all of Diana's friends, all of the things that they are going through are all the things that those soldiers are going through, and none of them want to be going through it. And there's something about, like, I'm fine, generally, with Wonder Woman, the character, killing people, because that's something that has been a part of her character fucking forever. She's an Amazonian warrior. Like, that's a big thing. But, like, generally, when Wonder Woman kills people in the comic books or the cartoons, that is, like, a more mature version of that character that kills people with, like, intentionality. And here, it's, like, having her kill German soldiers without understanding the scope of the war, without understanding that you running across this trenches does not help anybody. That doesn't save anything. That doesn't fix any fucking problem. That doesn't do anything to this war. These people have been stuck in these trenches for over a year, but moving that trench fucking like half a mile forward doesn't solve fucking anything. And I feel like the movie never admonishes Wonder Woman for that. It never like tells her. She never has, like, this part of the problems with the climax. She never has this revelation of, like, oh, shit, I've been fighting for people who are just as bad as the people I've been fighting against. Because, you know, another thing the movie never tells you is the British used fucking chemical weapons. The British committed fucking war crimes. Like, the whole movie is, like, it's all about how the Germans are developing this chemical weapon as if the British were not doing the exact same fucking shit at the exact same time. I feel like there's a weird missed beat where, like, I think that a much, like, cleaner, better version of this movie would have had Steve Trevor have some sort of backstory where he used chemical weapons. Like, he launched a fucking chemical weapon into an area that he thought the enemy were was at, but it actually attacked, like, mostly a civilian population, and most of them died because that's something that fucking happened, and that's why would making him sacrifice himself at the end of the movie would have resonated more, and have Wonder Woman understand more about how there is no good side to be taken. I feel like it's something the movie wants to tell you a lot at the end. It just says those lines over and over again, but it never shows me with conviction that that's what the movie really believes in. And that's like the story the movie is really telling about World War One. And it like really, it really hurt like those two moments of like the middle of the movie and the very end of the movie for me because of that.
Yeah. I wasn't thinking of those things while watching the movie, but I can still totally understand where you're coming from on that. I think we're in an interesting cultural moment where fiction, like Western fiction, is starting to bring World War One into the same pulp space that we've had World War II for a very long time. And I think there are discussions to be had about why we have World War II in that pulp space. And I don't think it's as clean as people make it out to be.
Sure, yeah.
That's not me saying like the Germans were good guys. No, Germans were fucking evil in World War II, and it's okay to show us shooting the Germans in World War II. But it also kind of erases a lot of the human suffering of World War II.
And, like, the sins of the Americans. And, yes. Like, you know, it's there's no clean, good war. Like, that's a myth.
Yeah, but overall, I think we as a society can be okay if we pick one war to put into the pulp stuff. It can be World War II.
Yeah, that's the easiest modern war to fit into a good versus evil narrative. That, like, I will not, like, be disgusted by.
Right. And I think what it comes down to is, if there is, I haven't seen it yet, I don't really think there's a way to bring World War One cleanly into a pulp narrative.
Maybe not, yeah.
I don't know what that would look like, because at that point it's not in the same pulpy space that superhero stories have to exist in. On a certain level, superhero stories have to have good guys and bad guys. And Wonder Woman tries to do a very similar narrative kind of trick that Captain America the First Avenger does, where Captain America is not fighting the Nazis, he's fighting
Hydra.
And Hydra is like a little offshoot, and really what that's there for is it's so Captain America doesn't affect real world history. It's, oh, we never heard about Hydra because Cap beat them before, you know, blah, blah, blah.
It also lets you do Captain America the First Avenger without, like, Captain America, like, discovering a fucking concentration camp, which would have been too heavy material for that movie.
Yes, and they basically try to do the same thing here, where there's an offshoot of the German army, and it's not them saying, like, this is German high command, it's this is this little offshoot doing this thing and blah, blah, blah. But, yes, it does not work as cleanly as it does in the Captain America scenario, because World War One, as we say, just isn't that pulpy. Like, you almost would have to, like, make up a country if you're going to do that and have them fighting that. And I think that would also be problematic in 100 different ways. You know, because, you know, I think if you drill down into the text enough, I think someone can make the argument, oh, but it's not the Germans they're fighting, it's the weird offshoot, blah, blah, blah. And I don't buy it.
The movie just puts that scene where the evil German dude kills German high command just to, like, give itself the slightest of outs. But it's like, that's fucking bullshit. And like, look, they're the Germans.
I think it's interesting to try to do the World War One thing. I think I admire the thematic, you know, line that is drawn between what Wonder Woman is learning and why you use World War One. But I also think, like, man, the themes that come from, like, all the things you're listing off that you kind of have to consider in that setting, I just cannot imagine a version of any superhero movie that could adequately deal with that.
Yeah, because it's something where they do, like... Because they, I think they do have a good idea and, like, identify a strong thematic resonance and have an argument for how Wonder Woman could fit into World War One with the themes they're telling. But it's just, like, again, they're just not... Like, this would have to be, R-rated. Not even, like, R-rated for violence. It would have to be R-rated for just, like, themes at some point of, like... It would be such a heavy movie. It would have such a gloomy fucking ending. Because it's like, there's no... Like, you can have an ending to a World War One narrative where you still have, like, faith and optimism in humanity. It's not like that is, like, automatically out the window. But it's like, it's a much harder sort of place to land in.
Let's say it this way. There's a reason why Ernest Hemingway never wrote a book with a happy ending.
Exactly. I mean, there's a reason why, like... There's a whole generation of, like, what modernist literature was, which is just sad, dark, depressing, like, extremely experimental, like, extremely averse to anything traditional. And it's, like, and it's one of my favorite areas of fiction from my times at college. So it's, like, it's the reason why I care about it so much. And it's why, like, it, like, really did, like, because I get, like, man, 99% of people, particularly 99% of Americans, don't know fucking anything about World War One, and I get that. And so for most people, it's not going to be a problem at all. Like, I saw plenty of comments online when I was looking up reviews and stuff of Wonder Woman after I saw it, of people basically saying, like, oh yeah, that was a kick-ass action scene where Wonder Woman took out a bunch of Germans. I'm like, you're talking about the Germans like they're Nazis here? The Germans, World War One, not fucking Nazis!
In fact...
Totally different thing!
In fact, if you want to get into the, you know, bigger cultural... historical, like, context, you could say the rest of the world had a pretty big role in allowing Hitler to rise to power by what we did to Germany after World War One, and, you know, forcing them into a recession from which the only thing that could rise was nationalism.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's just something where, like, I think, like, they I kind of commend them for sort of going for it, and, again, I think identifying something that is there, there's a story to be told, but at the same time... My ultimate conclusion is, like, they should not have gone with World War One. Like, okay. They should have just done World War Two. It's just, like, if you're not going to do it justice, like, just don't do it.
Maybe the next Wonder Woman movie can be Vietnam, and they can just open up this can of worms again.
Yeah, just go to, like, even messier conflicts.
Apocalypse Wonder Woman.
I mean, that is, like, thinking about, like, the future or whatever, it is a weird thing to think about. Another, like, consequence of setting it in World War One is, after the end of the movie, you're like... Well, wait, what did she do during World War II? Like, you do realize that World War II happens, like, fucking 20 years later, right? Like, this is not... It's not over. This isn't, like, the story isn't done. There's, like, something weird, because there's not a sense of finality with, like, the historical perspective we have now about the end of World War One. The end of World War One is just the setup for the beginning of World War II.
Yes.
So it's, like, it's another area where it's, like, really hard to have an optimistic ending of World War One, knowing where the future goes.
Yeah. So, you know, and... The movie doesn't have an overly optimistic ending. It does.
Sure.
It does end with the, you know, male lead dying.
Yeah, but he has, like, the big noble sacrifice that, like, again, I think, like, he needed it maybe... It's a good scene that needed... He maybe needed more of a character arc to fully, like, nail the sacrifice. Like, I feel like...
Yeah.
This is one of my issues with the Steve Trevor character is, like... The Steve Trevor we meet at the beginning of the movie would have made that sacrifice in just the same as the Steve Trevor at the end of the movie. Like, he never learned something over the course of the movie that makes you think, now this dude is ready to give himself up in a way he wouldn't have before.
But I think you can also get away with that when it's a secondary character and not your lead. So, anyway, we've talked about Wonder Woman way longer than we planned to, which says something. So, let's go ahead and move on and talk about Doctor Who.
The Eaters of the Light.
All right, so Doctor Who, The Eaters of Light, written by Rona Munro, who last wrote for the series a long time ago.
1989 in the last Doctor Who, classic Doctor Who serial Survival, where the Doctor, the Seventh Doctor and his companion Ace do battle against a race of cheetah people that have been sort of brought to Earth by the Master. And he's transforming people into cheetah people. And the Master, in and of himself, gets turned into a cheetah version of himself. And then the Doctor fights the Master in, like, a volcano planet and is about to smash him over the head because the Doctor's about to turn into a cheetah person. And then at the last second, he's like, no, I can't give in to this. And then the Doctor and Ace go off to have tea. And then the show got canceled.
I love Doctor Who.
It's pretty good.
All right.
I don't know if you've heard, but Doctor Who's pretty good.
It's pretty great. So Rona Munro becomes the first person to write for both eras of the show, which is awesome. And, you know, I think I've seen a lot of reviews that, like, you really use that as their starting point. And I actually don't want to do that. Maybe we can talk about that later. Just divorced of all of that.
Okay, yeah.
This was a really damn good episode of Doctor Who.
Yes.
It was wonderfully written. It was dense with ideas, but not in a way where those ideas felt like they were just being kind of thrown around like in a Mark Gatiss episode. Not to throw Mark Gatiss under the bus, but Mark, you've done it a lot. So, sorry. But like, no, this episode had a lot of ideas that I thought were constantly paying off. All the characters were written beautifully, including the side characters. It had a really unique idea for what story to tell. It made wonderful use of its setting. It was so Scottish, and I love that. The dialogue in particular just crackled throughout this thing. Peter Capaldi bit into it so wonderfully and beautifully. And I thought it had good character arcs for everyone. I thought it ended in an interesting place. And it completely fooled me when it ended. I thought it was longer than 45 minutes. And it's not. It's a normal length episode of Doctor Who. It feels like a 60-minute episode.
Yeah. It is packed with ideas. Like, yeah. It is brimming with good ideas.
It feels kind of like, not to say it's necessarily on the same level as this episode, but like the Neil Gaiman script, The Doctor's Wife.
Yeah.
That feels like a Doctor Who script that really had so much time and effort and love and care poured into it. And most, even some of the best Doctor Who episodes in modern Who, some elements of them just kind of wind up feeling rushed because the show is very busy. This felt like a script that was really poured over and loved and was made as the best version of itself.
Yeah.
Not a compromised version. And I loved it. I think this is one of the best of the season.
Yeah. No, it's just, it's awesome. It's like, I hate that you gave me this, like, muzzle on the classic Doctor Who comparison.
Go ahead, okay. But do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, like, but it's like, some people are overly psychologizing it. That's all.
Yeah, it's like really hard to not make the comparisons in some places, because I think there is a certain, it's like, it's impossible not to draw the comparisons, because I think whether it was written by her or not, like, there are these stylistic similarities between this story and late era Sylvester McCoy, which is one of, I think the most creatively rich eras in the show is his last two seasons, which is one of the reasons why it's so tragic that it got cut off, because Andrew Cartmell, the script editor, just decided, we're going to go fucking weird. We're going to take Doctor Who, which has been stale for years, and we're just going to get fucking nuts with it. And they got fucking nuts with it. You have episodes like, or stories like Ghostlight, which are just insane. You have just fucking what's like the greatest show on earth is really weird. Even Remembrance of the Daleks is a very strange episode in its pacing and the way like it sort of is trying to wrap in Doctor Who history in a way the series had not done up to that point.
And that's the Doctor Who winks in the credits, right?
Yes, that is where Sylvester McCoy's visage appears in the stars, and he does this weird like 3-frame wink at the audience that is the most delightful and creepy thing Doctor Who has ever done.
My one hope for Peter Capaldi's last episode is that they altered the theme song so he winks at us.
Oh, it would be brilliant. But yeah, like it was full on like deep 80s Doctor Who, because it's like the late 80s, and they just utterly went with it. You know, like Ace is one of the most original, like maybe still my favorite companion the show has ever had is Ace. And all that stuff. Like, it was just this really creatively vibrant, rich, experimental, crazy era of the show. And this so feels like that. Just, like, all the weird shit with, like, the crows talking is so... And, like, the doctor, like, saying it's like, oh, yeah, no, crows have always been able to talk. It's like, there's so many just total fucking Sylvester McCoy lines. Like, the way that the doctor is, like, weirdly dark and, like, kind of curt with people and very manipulative. Like, the way that
he's so mean in this episode.
Yeah, it's like the way he manipulates, like, the young Gaelic girl and, like, is very mean at first. And then he kind of, like, turns it on her and is, like, you can tell him kind of working her so that he can get her on his side. Like, it's so good. It feels like it comes from that sort of era. And just, like, all the, like, the fucking, like, weird portal where, like, time moves slow, where all the Light Eaters come from in the Seventh Legion. Like, there's so much stuff where the episode really does... I think we said that of this kind of about a couple of episodes this season, where it just feels like they found a way to take, like, a 4-episode-long classic Doctor Who serial. Although I think Survival was actually 3 episodes, and some of the Seventh Doctor ones were 3 episodes. But take that longer narrative format and compress it into a solid, like, 45-minute modern Doctor Who episode. And I think this is, like, maybe the most successful that has been this season of just feeling like you get that sense of pacing. Like you said, you feel like at the end, this was, like, an hour-long episode or something. Like, this definitely must have been an extra-long episode. But no, it's, like, 43 minutes long, the same as anyone else or any of the other episodes. It just has this sense of pace and movement and, like, this real lived-in, like, slow breathing feeling to it, where it can just move between these different scenes with these different groups of characters in the way that classic Doctor Who always would have the Doctor and the Companion split off and end up with different groups, because that was one of the ways that classic Doctor Who would manage to pad out some of their stories, was you get to like cut between these different factions, and here it feels like utterly vital to the story.
But you know, there's also a benefit to that, I think, in classic Who, where because, and again, I've obviously not seen as much classic Who as you have, but I've seen at least a story from every Doctor. And one of the things I noticed there is that they have to pad it out, but also when they have the big guests, you know, characters on classic Who, they tend, I think, to be better written than guest characters on Modern Who. And I think that is all, you know, mostly a function of time. Yeah. Modern Who does not usually, outside of like two-parters, does not usually have the time to really do a great job developing their side cast. But that is something that Classic Who lived and died on that lot of weeks, you know. And you have to have, you know, like, you remember a lot of things about the Fifth Doctor's last episode, Caves of Androzani. Yeah. You definitely remember the dude in the mask.
Yeah, the villain. Know? He's
like,
so good.
Like, you remember those things. And with Eaters of Light, I remember how they used the Doctor and Bill and Nardole did all that great. I also remember the Scottish girl. Yeah. And I remember the way they deal with, like, the sexuality of the Romans and that all these characters are young and how that is thematized. Like, it does, it feels like this great marriage of like the depth of classic Who and kind of the pace and wittiness of modern Who. It is a really good kind of marriage made in heaven of those things, you know? I love it. And the only reason I didn't want to psychologize all that too much is that, you know, I already saw a bunch of reviews where that's like all they wrote about. I'm like, well, what did you specifically like about the episode? So that's all I wanted to say. But no, you're absolutely right. It is a good comparison to make. And one of the things I would say is that, you know, the last two episodes before this were the two weakest of the season.
Yeah.
They weren't bad, but they had a lot of problems. And maybe my biggest issue with both of those episodes is I thought they sanded down the Doctor too much.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I could see Matt Smith or David Tennant playing a lot of the scenes in the last two episodes in a way more effectively than Peter Capaldi did. Not because of any problem on Capaldi's part, but because those didn't feel like 12th Doctor scenes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He was not too nice, but just kind of too low-key in a lot of ways.
Too, like, generic Doctor.
Yes. Yeah. And Capaldi is too good to be generic, you know?
Yeah.
And that is one of the great things about this era, is very rarely have they slipped up on writing him. And I thought Rona Monroe brought that back with ferocity here.
Yeah.
Where she de-sanded those edges. And he was prickly and brilliant, but also with a purpose. Where he's an absolute dick to that Scottish girl. But by the end, you see why, and she is inspired by that in a really interesting way, and that relationship is really interesting.
Yeah, it definitely pulls, like, the prickly, like, First Doctor, Sixth Doctor, Seventh Doctor, like, the just, like, weird, like, man, you're a fucking dick, but, like, but you're a dick with a purpose. Like, you have a reason why you're doing this. And it's also, is like, reminding me a little bit more of, like, Series 8, 12th Doctor, where, like, he definitely was a little bit more hard-edged, and I, like, liked bringing that back up, because you don't see it all the time anymore.
And I think the first half of the season did a lot of that in different places.
Yeah.
And so that's honestly the biggest thing that made the last two episodes of this season feel out of place, is they felt like they were out of a different season in terms of how they were characterizing the Doctor and Bill and everyone. And here it's like, yeah, we're right back on track. Like, I have no worries going into the finale after this.
Yeah.
Also, just because those last scenes with Missy on the TARDIS were outstanding.
Yes,
and
yeah.
Whoever wrote those. Those are probably Moffat scenes, just knowing how these things are done, but they're still very well done. Yeah, so, and Peter Capaldi, you could just tell he was having a ball with some of this dialogue. He's outstanding in this episode.
Scott, he's just, it's just like you, because I think it was because the last two episodes have been kind of lackluster. Then even, like, you know, whenever he's there, he's fucking awesome. But it was like we were kind of away from, like, peak fucking badass Peter Capaldi Doctor for 2 weeks. And then coming back to it, it's like, man, he's just so good.
He's so good. I love the resolution to his arc in this one. Because it's, you know, it doesn't specifically reference Heaven Sent. It doesn't specifically reference what he's got. Well, it kind of does, that he's got the vault back home and all these things. But you can feel the Doctor just wanting to wallow in his emotional, you know, brokenness.
Yeah.
And just go in and, you know, punch a glass wall a million times again. Right?
Yeah.
Like, you can kind of feel that there. And I think, you know, this writer clearly understood where the 12th Doctor's head is at this moment in the series. And it, you know, this was a standalone, quote-unquote, episode, but I thought it advanced the character arcs beautifully.
Yeah.
And ending in that way, and then it being that the Doctor inspired these people too much, and he can't get away with it, and that these people are going to go save their world for themselves. That is one of the best versions of that kind of Doctor Who ending. It's not like we haven't seen a version of that before.
Yeah.
This was outstanding.
But it was another one that, it just felt real Seventh Doctor to me in some specific ways. There's something about, it's particularly like the music, like what they do with the music and the music echoing after, where it's just like, it feels so, it's just, I don't even know how to describe it. It's just like, I don't know. I didn't realize how, I think, distinctive some of that late Seventh Doctor stuff was stylistically until I saw this episode. Like, and realized, oh, this is, like, regardless of, like, I have no idea if this is because she specifically wrote late Seventh Doctor stuff, whatever. Like, she just, like, captures that feeling and tone in the way that, like, made me feel really powerfully nostalgic for that style. And it is that, like, sense of the Doctor pushing people too far and, like going, like, you, where you're like not 100% sure if maybe the Doctor played everything 100% right this time out. Where like usually I feel like in modern Doctor Who, you have a certain amount of confidence in him doing the right thing. I think it's one of the things they found a good space in again with the 12th Doctor that sometimes they don't always remember. It's like he's incredibly fallible, and sometimes like he makes people die because he's around. He doesn't always just, oh, every time, he doesn't save everybody.
And that's been like the theme of this season. Yeah. So yeah, this was a great kind of, you know, denouement in some ways to this season, even if we've got the actual climax to come.
Yeah, it's like a nice palate cleanser to like setting up the sort of two-parter climax.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk about the other two main characters. Bill, also, who I think was kind of misused in the last two episodes. I love Bill.
Yeah.
Pearl Mackie is so good. I really hope she sticks around for the next
Me
Doctor.
Too.
She's too good to throw away. She's so great. And giving her, like, this is one of the only proper companion is on their own episodes we've gotten this season. And you know, you don't usually get those too early into a companion's run, but we got that here. And you know, I love her relationship with the Romans. I love that the episode starts because Bill and the Doctor are having an argument about the Legion.
Yeah.
The Ninth Legion. And so Bill just... I also love that the Doctor's like, yeah, go wander off by the river in wherever the hell we are.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just... I love that. And Bill finds the Romans and the whole thing about... Again, I think they've generally used Bill's sexuality in very nice, interesting ways this season. And her talking to the Romans and realizing to them it's not a big deal was hilarious.
Yeah, I like the lines they give the Roman soldier are really good about, like, you know, I think it's really great how limited you are. It's just like, it's a really funny version. I think, like, it's a scene that could play off as, like, too corny, I think, very easily. But they hit the right note with it, for sure.
And I think with what they did with, like, her ethnicity in the ice episode.
Yeah.
What's that called? The
Thin Ice?
Thin Ice, yeah. I think this was a good bookend to that.
Yeah.
Where we get different kind of historical perspectives on these things. Because, yeah, Bill would be an anomaly in many historical time periods. But I like that she, in some ways, is not here.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the many ideas going on here, and it's specifically tied to Bill's character, is language and how that's used, and that I kind of like... I hadn't even really realized that Bill didn't know about the TARDIS's translation field.
Yeah, because he hasn't been in a lot of scenarios where it would be obvious.
Right.
Know?
But, and it's usually never used as a plot point.
Yeah.
Usually it's like the if it's there at all, it's the companion says, how do I understand them?
Yeah.
And Doctor says, TARDIS, the mumbo jumbo.
Yeah.
And
psychic field. It's
Yeah. And then you just go on with it. Here it's an actual plot and thematic point. And one, you get some very funny dialogue between her and the Romans with it.
Yeah.
But then later on, it's like, because they can all talk, they can work these things out. It's just one of the many kind of heady ideas this episode is using that it pays off on.
Yeah, and I do love, like, that. It's like, man, the scene where, like, the storylines converge again and the Bill and Doctor encounter each other again, and that's where it sort of, like, the full, like, TARDIS language, like, telepathic matrix stuff comes into play, where you realize, oh, right, it's not just that the Doctor and Bill can talk to all these people, it's that these people can now talk to each other. I've never seen that before. And I'm happy that it's another one of those things that's like been a sort of theme in this season that the past couple episodes haven't had, is being like, this seems like something that must have happened to Doctor Who at some point, but I've seen all of them. I can't remember there ever being a scene where they highlight the effect that would have on the other side characters that already exist in this world and not specifically on the Doctor and his companions. And that's just such a good, rich idea that it seems like insane that it's never been done before. But I can't think of it. If it has been done, I can't think of what episode it would have been.
Yeah, so it's very cool. Nardole, He's so funny in this.
So funny. The fucking scene where the doctor comes back out and Nardole has, like, totally acclimated himself and has the tattoos and everything is so good.
It's so good. And, you know, all I've wanted from Nardole all season is an episode where he has a solid adventure by the side of the doctor. Mm-hmm. And we mostly haven't gotten that because Bill has, for good reason, been the primary companion.
Yeah.
But I wanted that kind of, I felt like Empress of Mars should have done that. But here we actually get it where for the majority of the episode, it's the Doctor with Nardole as his sidekick, not specifically Bill. And they just have such a wonderful chemistry.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need a full season of it, but, you know, we had those two specials and then a nice episode here. It's good.
Yeah.
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 Nardole is a treasure.
Yeah, it's nice when these episodes get to make good use of him because he's really great.
Again, like I don't know if you know Matt Lucas should stick around as like a series regular next year, but I hope Chris Chibnall doesn't ignore that he's there.
Yeah, I hope like even if he's not a full companion, like he comes up every now and then.
Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't you want to bring Matt Lucas back and do a fun Nardole episode?
Yeah,
like a Christmas special or something. You know,
yes.
It'd be fun. Yeah, with whoever the next Doctor is, because again. Nardole is such a unique character where I can see him next to any doctor in my mind. It's so weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then you do have those side characters, and it's a theme that takes a while to emerge, and it emerges, I think, very organically, that these are all kids.
Yeah.
And I think that's very interesting, that, like, the adults died fighting the battle, and now it's all kind of the kids having to make these decisions. And, again, it's not something the episode pays lip service to. I think it explores it pretty actively in that these kids are scared.
Yeah.
And they don't really know how to react. And they don't know how to operate in these scenes. And it's kind of... I love that the Doctor kind of inspires the Scotsman. But Bill is the one who kind of raises up the Romans.
Yeah.
And it's a great little parallel story they do.
And it's something that I think is one of the reasons why this episode needs to be placed this late in the season. Because there's some elements of the episode that feels like it could be placed anywhere. But specifically for Bill's story arc, I think it's like important that this is like... Other than, I guess, like the two episodes ago or whatever, the end of the Mummy trilogy. She was kind of working on her own, but that episode wasn't very good. So it doesn't necessarily always have that kind of impact. Here it feels right that like... She has spent enough time with the Doctor and learned enough that she can navigate this kind of like plot on her own and not need him by her side all the time. And it's an important sort of stage in her character development.
Yeah, because we got those with Clara all the time.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, Bill, you know, isn't the same kind of person as Clara, and she kind of needed... She also was a new companion, and so we're getting into that. And comparing that to like a Clara episode, where Bill... moves much more kind of instinctually through the world, but that's also so charming, and she's able to inspire these characters in ways other companions like a Clara, like an Amy, wouldn't be able to do.
Yeah. So. It also helps, like, another, like, the going back to the age thing, one thing I really like is it puts into perspective, one, like, the Doctor's age, like, he gets to, like, play that very well about, like whatever about him being, like, 2,000 years old. It's just about him being, like, the grandpa in the group. I think, like, Peter Capaldi has good material with that. But I think it's one of the cool things, like, kind of, like, dark things, I guess, about the scenes with Bill and the Romans is the realization that, like, because I don't think they ever have, like, they don't ever use the dialogue to specifically point it out, but it's, like, the one guy who's in charge says, like, I'm the oldest, I'm the grandpa, like, because I'm the oldest, and I'm in charge. It's just, like, how old are you? He says he's, like, 18 or 19 or something, and you know Bill is in college. She's, like, probably a year or two older than this guy. Like, she's actually the oldest one there, and I think, like, that helps put that into, like, perspective in a way that's nice because they don't have to... have anyone tell it to you. You just get to read it off of Bill's reaction and that revelation of like, right, she's like, she's not old, but she's an adult and they are still basically children.
Yeah, and again, Pearl Mackey is so good, and it's easy to kind of spend all our time praising Capaldi, especially when we know he's gonna be leaving soon.
Yeah.
We don't really know what her status is going forward, but she deserves a lot of praise for this whole season, and I thought this was one of her best episodes in terms of performance.
Yeah.
What else is there to talk about? The cinematography was beautiful with the Scottish Highlands and everything.
Yeah, it's nice when they get these like nice like on location kind of shots. It reminded me a bit of like the beginning of the second episode, Smile or whatever, with like all the wheat fields and stuff. When they get to have like these nice natural landscapes, they make very good use of it.
I really liked the monster.
Yeah, I thought like it was a good design, and they made good use of like not have other than like at the very end. It's sort of like off to the side. You don't get a good look at it for a long time.
You see the tentacles.
Yes.
And that's what's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this episode just worked so well. It's really, it might be my favorite of the season. I loved it.
Yeah, it's up there. Like, I think one of the things I'm really looking forward to with it is a rewatch, because that's one of the things of it being so packed with all these ideas about language and age and, like, the period and stuff, and just, like, weird, the time dilation, all that shit. If one of those, like, with late era Seventh Doctor, like, Ghostlight, I think it's going to, like, really reward repeat viewings.
So, yeah. Absolutely. So let's talk about the last scene, where we get back to the TARDIS, and Missy is just there, because the Doctor, something's going on with him and Missy. And you know, we get Missy again seeming rehabilitated, but also not, and we get another really nice discussion. And it's a scene that, for a final scene of an episode, breathes more than these usually do.
Yeah.
Of her and the Doctor talking, and her saying, you know, do you think these tears are real or something? And him saying, you know, if it's working, that's what it is. It's this interesting little thematic thing where he has these very high, dark expectations of her, and she seemingly is playing along, even though it's very difficult.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating character dynamic that, like, I think it's smart that they haven't yet, like, done a full episode on it, because I think it would be, it's, like, a really delicate space for the characters to be in, but it's, like, alluding to this relationship that we have, we know about, like, even if you just know, like, New Doctor, you sort of, like, get a sense of the sort of, like, weird frenemy thing that the Doctor and the Master have, but it's also just having them be able to have this quiet moment, or whether or not you fully believe that the Master is on the, it's on turning to the side of the good or whatever, like, you get to just have this quiet moment of them talking to each other. It reminds me a lot of the Davros episode from season 9,
yes,
where it's like, you don't usually get to see this. Like, you don't get to see whether or not how this relationship turns out. You don't get to see, like, a scene of these two characters just talking to each other, because they're always at each other's throats, and that's a really fascinating dynamic.
And you know what's most fascinating about it to me? The one who feels dangerous in those scenes is Peter Capaldi.
Yeah.
Michelle Gomez, I think you can read, she's phenomenal in these scenes. She has been better than ever this season, and what a ride that character has taken. But, like, she's great. But what's so fascinating to me in those scenes is I'm not sure what she's up to, but I'm really not sure what he's up to.
Yeah.
And he seems like, when it's just him and Missy, and, like, they're below the below decks on the TARDIS talking, he seems, like, coiled and ready to strike in a weird way. And I think that's intentional. Yeah. I think Stephen Moffat wants us to go into the finale as unsure of him as we are of her.
Absolutely. Like, one of the things I love about those scenes, because we've gotten now a kind of, like, a couple of them, but this is definitely the longest one, with the Doctor and the Missy and the TARDIS at the end, is like, a dark inversion of those kinds of scenes we got all, like, almost at the end of every episode of Season 9, between the Doctor and Clara in the TARDIS, where we did, you know, our Season 9 podcast episodes, we would always remark on, like, how good those scenes are, because they're, like, these nice, quiet, kind of personal, intimate scenes that sort of allude to something darker a lot of times, but also feel very warm. And here it's just like, you get this, but with the Master and the Doctor, and it's like, there is a certain warmth and intimacy to it, but it's also just like, where the fuck is this going to go?
I mean, it, in a weird way, it feels like the Doctor is using Missy.
Yeah.
In a way where, you know, the Master has used the Doctor before.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting, and I love the setup for next week.
Oh my God.
That is an amazing idea for an episode.
The next time preview for it was just, holy shit.
That's a great idea for an episode. If you haven't seen it, I mean, it's basically that the Doctor is going to send Missy on a Doctor Who mission.
Like, yeah.
To be Doctor Who. And how has the show never done that?
Mm-hmm.
That is such a, I, like, feels like Stephen Moffat looking at his list of, like, what, I've got 3 episodes left, what haven't I done?
Yeah.
Here's the craziest idea on my list.
It almost feels like, I have no idea if this is the case, obviously, but it almost feels like this is the reason why he reintroduced the Master.
Yeah.
Was to, like, because you couldn't do that without having an established relationship with a version of the Master to then be able to find it interesting for him/her to play that role, to, like, be a surrogate Doctor in an episode. It's like this slow build-up, and, like, it also, like, you know, dovetailing very nicely with, I think, them learning how to sort of write this version of the Master and write for Michelle Gomez to the point where, like, she's so fucking good in this episode. That makes it so exciting, that prospect of, like, who knows, like, how long, if that conceit's going to last the whole episode or whatever, but, like, it's such a good idea. But even that, for me personally, is not the most exciting thing about the next time preview.
I know what you're saying.
The next time preview, and this is something that has been kind of was hinted at in, like, the big season-long next time preview in the first episode, but I didn't want to comment on there because I didn't know if they're really going to lean into it, because it's, like, just a shot or two. there is a full-on shot in this Next Time preview of a fucking computer screen with the motherfucking word Mondas on it. Peter Capaldi says the words Mondasian Cybermen, and we see some motherfucking Mondasian Cybermen as if they stepped out of, like, off the set of 10th Planet, walked into a cryogenic chamber, and got reawoken 50 fucking years later to be on a new episode of Doctor Who. And holy shit, that is such a good idea.
Yep.
For people who do not know, Mondasian Cybermen are the original Cybermen from the 10th Planet, which is the last First Doctor serial where they were originally introduced. And that version, that's the only time that, like, specific version of the Cybermen have ever been used. Like, that background of them being from the planet Mondas, which is, like, an ancient twin planet for Earth that got spun out, like, really far away from the sun, and so the planet
got... I hope we get all of that.
The planet froze over, and in the process of that, the humans on that, like, the Mondasian humans had to cybernetically sort of, like, replace parts of themselves over time to survive in this new hostile world, and then slowly the orbit of Mondas brings it back around towards Earth, and by that point they are all Cybermen now, and they wanted to sort of like take over Earth and have it be their new planet because they don't want to go all the way out and go on the whole cycle, because it's probably like a be kind of a bummer if your like planetary orbit brought you like fucking that far away from the sun that your planet freezes all the way over. So that's kind of the plot of 10th Planet and the background of the Cybermen. And it's a great background. The 10th Planet's a fantastic story. It also got, relatively recently, this a couple of years ago, it got the missing episodes were animated reconstructed. So you can find DVDs of that, and they're very good reconstructions. It's a great story. But also, it is personally, I don't think it's the best Cybermen story. Like, I think that's either Tomb of the Cybermen or The Invasion in the second Doctor era. But those are the most interesting versions of the Cybermen because they are so weird. They are, like, the effects are really bad, but they are bad in such a way that, like, I think navigates a much more interesting space for the Cybermen of being more organic than they are cyber, where they're not just robots. And the Cybermen turned very quickly into being just robots, and that's fucking boring. Having them be these weird, kind of, like, fleshy, organic, because they're not... They don't have big tin suits on. They have just basically, like, pantyhose or something. Like, white pantyhose over their head with, like, eye holes cut out that have, like, black things put over them. So you can see, like, the flesh and, like, muscles moving underneath the costume. And that added a really powerful element, along with a lot of other things that I'm sure we'll talk about more in depth in next week's episode, seeing on how they live up to the potential of Mondasian Cybermen. But all of that makes me really excited to see what they do with it, because I think it is... And I felt this for so long, and Peter Capaldi has said for so long in interviews that this is like the number, it was like his stock answer for, if there's one monster I want to bring back from classic Doctor Who, it would be the Mondasian Cybermen. He's been saying that since like before he actually was in an episode, because that's a fucking question that if you've ever seen an interview with him, every interviewer asks him, because obviously he was watched Doctor Who when he was a kid. And the idea of them bringing that back, potentially rehabilitating the modern Cybermen into something that's much more interesting by going back to its roots, that's such an exciting idea to me. So
it feels very fitting for a season that has cut real deep on yes. Classic Who stuff, up to and including having a Classic Who writer come back.
Yes.
I'm so excited.
It's such a great idea on both bringing back the Mondasian Cybermen and having Missy play the Doctor in an episode.
And we're going to see John Sim again?
Yes, right. That was also in that... That was what a fucking action-packed teaser that fucking Next Time thing was.
The other night, I was kind of bored and I was surfing YouTube and watching Doctor Who clips, as you do.
Yeah.
And I watched...
I've definitely been there.
I was watching John Sim's last scene from David Tennant's last episode. Phenomenal scene.
Yeah.
That's a great episode. It's weird because... What's that serial called? The End of Time.
Yeah, End of Time.
End of Time Part 1 is horrible.
Yeah.
End of Time Part 2 is great.
Yes.
And the last scene where you have Timothy Dalton as Rassilon there.
Yeah.
And you have John Sim. And you have the Doctor cut up and with the gun pointed between them and all that. And he's trying to figure out what to do. Is a phenomenal scene. And there's this whole interplay where David Tennant says, "Get out of my way." And the Master moves and he shoots the link thing. And then the Doctor is about to die at the hands of Rassilon. And the Master says, "Get out of my way." And then he like sends Rassilon into the void. And that's where he disappears. John Sim had a very up and down run as the Master.
Yes.
But when he was allowed to be good, he was really good. And that's one of those scenes where, like, watch that scene. He is so good in that scene. Frankly, watch all of The End of Time. He's great in that. Or End of Time Part 2. He's great in that one. And I'm excited to see what he can do in a time when Doctor Who is treating the Master well.
Yes.
You know? So, yeah. And I mean, there's also the speculation game to play. Is Missy on the up and up?
Who knows? Like, yeah, the like, what is, do they do with the Master? Because, like, it's another one of those interesting things. It seems like it should have happened at some point. There has never been a Master crossover. But partially, or mostly probably because there have only really been three, other than, like, modern Doctor Who, there's only really been three actors to play the Master. It's, like, Roger Delgado, who passed away tragically in a car accident. Then Jeffrey Beavers took over the role, like, for a short time. And there was Anthony Ainley was the Master for, like, 5th, 6th, 7th Doctor era. So it's like they've never done that crossover before, so I have no idea what... There's no, like, framework to tell you what is that relationship between two different incarnations of the Master. Like, are Missy and Johnson Master going to be combative? Are they working together? Who knows?
Because I would not have said this going into this season when we kind of knew this was coming, but my prediction at this point is that I think Missy is kind of on the up and up here, and it could be whatever John Sim's machinations are that are the real threat.
Yeah.
Because I doubt he is. You don't want John Sim playing the Master and have him be a nice guy.
Yeah.
No reason for that. Yeah, I'm excited.
Yes. I'm also excited that John Sims Master gets to have a beard. And it feels like it was something that was always missing. Maybe the key element that was missing, that if he had just had the beard, everyone else would have fallen in line and known what to do with him.
Yeah. I am so excited.
I'm really excited. It's the most excited I've been for a finale since, I guess, season 9 of Doctor Who. But, like, most Doctor Who season finales in modern Doctor Who, I'm not excited for at all, because it always seems like this is probably going to fall flat on its face. This seems like it's going to be really fucking good.
And this is the start of the final run of episodes for both Moffat and Capaldi.
Yeah.
This episode we're talking about, Eaters of Light, that's the last one in the Moffat era not written by Moffat.
It's true.
We've got this finale, two-part finale, and then we've got the Christmas special, and we'll see what happens. But this has been a really good season.
Yeah, definitely. Like, it has been a really good season for a really good run of episodes, for a really good, like, pair of three seasons, I guess, for Peter Capaldi and for Stephen Moffat.
Moffat and Capaldi going out on top
over
that cliff together. Love it. All right. That's Doctor Who.
Yes.
So good. Twin Peaks. So good.
So fucking good.
All right. Twin Peaks, The Return, Part 7. Spoilers from here on out.
How could you possibly talk about it without talking in spoilers? But even if you talk about it in spoilers, do the spoilers make any sense without the context?
Maybe not, but here's the thing. This is an episode where they kind of would more.
Sure.
Because this was an unusually plot-heavy episode of Twin Peaks.
Yeah, we take a small step away in this episode from the Doogie stuff. Like, it comes in at the end, but for most of the episode, we are away from Dougie, we are away from Cooper, and we are just off in...
We're away from one version of Cooper.
That is a good point, yes. We are spending a lot of time with Evil Cooper, we're spending a lot of time with the FBI, with Gordon Cole, we are spending a lot of time... We like, get to touch up on the corpse of Bobby's dad from the corporal, or the colonel from the original Twin Peaks.
Major Briggs.
Major Briggs, thank you, that's what his name is. And so we get to touch up on that and, like, kind of clarify that that is what they're doing, I guess, that is his corpse, maybe?
Who
knows?
There's
also, like, a homeless dude that really ominously walks in from the background of that shot that never comes up again. That felt like that another thing that felt like it was just like, what the fuck?
But
it was one of the many moments of Twin Peaks that returned that felt like, is this just an unused shot from Mulholland Drive? Like, what the fuck is this?
Amazing. But no, I mean, one of the most notable things actually is that this episode is pretty heavily set in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And it actually doesn't cut away from Twin Peaks for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
At the beginning, which is kind of fascinating because, again, most of this show called Twin Peaks has not happened in Twin Peaks.
Yes.
Which is wonderful. We'll talk about all the story stuff in a second. It's easy to forget. What's the first scene of this episode, Sean?
I can't think off the top of my head what it was.
Bearded Jerry Horn
in the woods. Yes.
He calls Ben, and so we get more Richard Boehmer, who, as a lot of people pointed out, looks like David Letterman without the beard, which is very true. And he says, "Someone stole my car." And Richard Boehmer says, "What?" He says, "Didn't I tell you? I think I'm high. I don't know where I am." And it's a complete non sequitur. Yeah. We do get more Ben Horn later in the episode, though the scene is not at all connected to the Jerry thing. And it's just, I love Jerry Horn, David Patrick Kelly, in that scene with the fucking beard. And he just says, "I don't know where I am."
It's they have made very good use of Jerry so far.
He's only had three scenes.
He's only had three scenes. They've been three killer fucking scenes, though.
Oh, absolutely. So that was a great little, like, total non sequitur to start the episode.
Yeah.
And it kind of ended with something of a non sequitur, too, but we'll get to that. So that was great. And then we're back to, and frankly, they addressed this way sooner than I thought they would, Hawk and Sheriff Truman, other Sheriff Truman, are sitting at the table with the letter he found last week, and it's from Laura Palmer, and it's harkening back not just to Firewalk with Me, but to the deleted scenes of Firewalk with Me, because of course Lynch is doing that. And this actually is in the finished movie proper, is the scene where Laura Palmer has the vision from Annie Blackburn, like when she's lying in bed and all that. And she does, in the movie proper, she writes that down in her diary, and Leland steals those pages. And now we get the other side of that, where apparently Leland put those pages in the bathroom in the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Office. And so now we're reading about this, and so now Hawk and Sheriff Truman have this piece of information that Laura Palmer had some kind of vision that Coop did not come out of the Black Lodge. And it's in an episode where everyone searching for Coop starts to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
They're never going to really figure out all of it, because it's a crazy story, but they start to at least figure out that Coop we're hearing about isn't the same Coop.
Yeah. And it's one of the things that is, like, maybe the strangest and most amazing thing about this Twin Peaks reboot is how, like, there's one side of it that is, like, such a straightforward, literal continuation of the plot of Twin Peaks and Firewalk with Me in a way I would have never thought that David Lynch would ever be interested in exploring, because it felt like so much of that is happened because the show fucking blew off the rails in season 2, and he desperately kind of cobbled it together at the end of season, in the season 2 finale, which is insane, and Firewalk with Me, which is insane. And so you thought, like, well, of course that's just going to get swept under the rug. And there's no way he's going to bring up the ring. There's no way he's going to bring up the fucking diary. There's no way he's going to bring up the fucking bank explosion. There's no way he's going to bring up any of this shit, because there's no way you can make a fucking story. There's no way you're even going to... I didn't even really believe they were going to have Bob possess Coop and have Coop come out of the Red Room. Any of that shit. I didn't think any of that shit was going to come back up. And somehow, this series is doing all of it with such specific fucking detail that it's calling back to things that happened to delete the scenes of the movie. It's calling back to, like, details from the fucking, like, pilot that never really went anywhere. It's so meticulous in how it's carrying on the plot from Twin Peaks. And then at the same time, it's playing this incredible game of dangling the main character from Twin Peaks, the character that everybody loves to death, the, like, one of the most iconic characters in television history, and just fucking dangling him in front of your face and saying, like, oh, he's gonna become the character you love any second now, I promise. And he continues to be this, like, zombified, slow-shuffling man with weird vision powers that you can kind of maybe see the beautiful Cooper trapped inside, but you can't get him yet. And I love that that is somehow the fucking tightrope that David Lynch has decided to walk in the series.
David Lynch and Mark Frost.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
I don't want to forget it, because I, you know, obviously I think Mark Frost probably is more in the trenches with what the details of Twin Peaks were, but I love that both of them decided this was the way to go. And in retrospect, this was the absolute best thing they could have done.
Yeah.
I just would never have expected it.
It's like, it feels like it's their most, they're on one hand, like, heavily honoring and respecting the original series, and on the other hand, they're just kind of flipping it off. And I love that, like, I thought it was going to be one or the other. I love that they're doing both at the same time.
They're doing both in the same episode.
Exactly. They're doing both in the same scenes.
I know. I mean, but here's the thing, like, this episode fills in a huge amount of detail of the missing 25 years between the series. So, like, in that scene with Hawk and Sheriff Truman, we get, you know, Hawk talking about, like, the last day they saw Cooper and that he left Twin Peaks shortly thereafter. And then we have that scene where he says, Sheriff Truman asks who else saw him that day, and it turns out it was Doc Hayward. Yeah. We'll talk about that scene more in depth. But then we get the scene with Doc Hayward and what he saw of Coop, and that Coop basically got up out of the hospital and just kind of ran away. We get that stuff from the FBI where they have one picture of Evil Cooper from those 25 years, and it's him looking like a fucking boss down
it's
in
like
Rio
a
or something.
Picture from fucking Scarface or something. It's so good.
I love it. I love that. I want there to be a DVD bonus feature of Kyle MacLachlan having to pose for these ridiculous photos of him as Dougie and him as Evil Coop and stuff.
Yeah.
And him just looking stylish as hell.
Yes.
But yeah, so they have that picture of him, and apparently that was like some kind of criminal ring he was working for. And then you have all this stuff with Diane. Again, we'll get into it more later, where something happened between Diane and Evil Cooper, and, you know, this kicked off whatever happened. And then we also have Evil Cooper and the Warden, and that he has dirt on this dude. So, like, it's all somewhat opaque, but we are getting, like, specific details of what happened when Cooper's body came out of the Black Lodge, but he wasn't in there.
Yes, it is tying all these threads together in a way that, like, as someone who, like, recently rewatched through all of Twin Peaks and Fire Walk With Me and the deleted scenes of Fire Walk With Me, it, like, it all fucking makes sense.
It does.
How is that even possible? I don't understand.
It's weird because I've been thinking this for a couple episodes now, but this one solidified it for me. I love the original Twin Peaks. It's a masterpiece. It does so many wonderful things. Outside of the pilot, it's not all that narratively, like, assured a show
yeah.
in terms of direction. This Showtime series is somehow, in some crazy weird way, I think more narratively coherent and assured a show than original Twin Peaks was.
I agree. Like, it feels like they have a specific vision that they did not necessarily have in Twin Peaks. Like, they had a vision for Twin Peaks originally, but it wasn't like a narrative vision. It wasn't like, this is where the Laura Palmer thing is going to go, this is how we're going to wrap it up, blah, 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 blah. It was like, we're going to set up this mystery, set up all these interesting characters, and kind of just play with that world, and that worked great for what original Twin Peaks was until it didn't work so great anymore. But this is like, you can just feel... They sat down and they were like, we're going to make new fucking Twin Peaks and we're going to make this much of it and we're going to write all these scripts. We're going to film all these episodes. We're going to get all these people back. And it's like this insane, like, what's going to be like this 18-hour long, like, really directed specific narrative that, like, obviously it has this, like, subplots and stuff, but it feels as slow paced as it is. And I love the slow pace of it. It feels like really incredibly narratively tight.
Yes, it's novelistic. And yeah. I know it can be hackneyed to make that comparison. This is a novelistic TV show in that it feels like every week we're getting a chapter. And as you move through that chapter, you learn more and more. But it has kind of the slow pace of a novel where, you know, you might see us, like, people have been saying, oh, we haven't seen that Becky character played by Amanda Seyfried in a couple of weeks. And I'm like, we will. Yeah. I know we will. It's just been obvious that everything is connected so far because we've also gone weeks without seeing Hawk's investigation or something. And it just feels like, you know, every 50 pages or so, we're going to get back to something and tie it in more. And there is no part of this series so far that has not, even seven episodes in, started to kind of stitch together.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly where it's going, but I am 100% confident at this point that Mark Frost and David Lynch absolutely do.
Yeah.
And that's a cool... I mean, these are master storytellers, and they know what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's just, when you feel that in a TV show, it's so great.
Yeah, especially when you were not in any way expecting to go again.
I mean, you know, I think if you had asked me, what are the odds, you know, what are you taking, is this more likely to be a direct continuation of Twin Peaks with some other weird stuff, like what we got? Or is it more likely to be a straight-up reboot where they retell the story of Twin Peaks, but everyone is 25 years older just because that would be weird? I would have said the latter.
Yeah, me too.
That would have been more likely to me. But we got this, and it's wonderful. So let's see. What else do we have to talk about there? Let's talk about the two scenes with Sheriff Truman here.
Yeah.
So first we have him on the phone with Harry, who we don't hear. You know, Michael Aunt Keen is not in this. But the character is kind of there in spirit, and sounds like he's sick. You know, Truman calls him to kind of get help with the case, but he realizes Harry is in no place to deal with this. And, you know, that scene ends with him saying, do me a favor, beat this thing.
Yeah.
And, God, Robert Forster is good in this.
Yeah.
I mean, Robert Forster is this good in everything he's ever done because he's a genius.
Yeah.
But there are two scenes in this episode where he is acting opposite an empty screen.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we see a part of the screen later, but obviously that was not there when he shot it.
Yeah.
And he makes those scenes work. A lesser actor, I think those scenes wouldn't work.
Yeah, also, like, he's given this really tough thing that I think is, like, really hard. And we've seen, like, in tons and tons of TV shows of actors not being able to do this well, of being thrown into a cast of characters that, like, your character is not originally designed to be in. Like, obviously, in the original envisioning of these scripts, you can assume that it was original Sheriff Truman, but then Michael Ancine didn't want to come back because he retired from acting, and so they had to figure out something else to do and rewrite the scenes and cast a new character. And so, like, that is such a hard place to be in. And, like, having to act opposite all these characters that people who are fans of the show are very familiar with and fit in very naturally. And I think he's done that spectacularly.
Absolutely. And he plays that scene so beautifully with Harry. And you feel it. You feel like a brother dealing with the death of his other brother or the impending death.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like we're probably going to have that written into the narrative at some point.
Probably, yeah.
And it's great. And I love that Robert Forster is at a phase in his career where he just pops up on TV shows doing his thing. Like, he did that on Breaking Bad near the end of that show. I love Robert Forster. If you haven't seen Jackie Brown, just go watch Jackie Brown.
Yeah.
And then the other scene is he gets on Skype with Doc Hayward.
Yes.
And he has a rising monitor screen in his desk with wood around it.
It is the most amazing thing, because it's something that we talked a lot about the like first two episodes, was there's a lot of weird technology stuff, and that feels like it's kind of come up in bits and pieces here and there, but it's mostly receded to the background, and then it comes, like, slaps you in the face. It's just like this big fucking screen that comes out of his, like, nice wooden desk, and he just has... And, like, it is not just he has a Skype call. It's, like, it's the process of the Skype call. Is he's talking to Doc Hayward on the phone. Is like, what's your Skype handle, Doc? It's, like, Sam finds out what it is. The screen slowly comes out. You see him pick up a mouse. And, like, you don't see the screen, but you can see him move a mouse. Which, like, you never see a character in a TV show ever move a mouse. It's, like, for whatever reason, it's utter anathema to showing computers in televised media. Everything is always controlled by a keyboard, even though that's not how you ever interface with a computer exclusively, but he clicks on some sort of desktop icon, presumably Skype with a mouse, and then he types slowly, Hunt and Peck style, putting in his password and everything, and then he starts a Skype call with Doc Hayward.
How much do you want to bet Robert Forster probably knows how to type and just typed that normally, and then Lynch said, cut, Robert, that's great, but I need you to Hunt and Peck. It's gotta be slow.
It's like, okay, click, 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 click. No, that's, no, that's great. Slower. Click. There you go.
I can totally imagine that.
Yeah.
It's great. I can also imagine David Lynch has that computer desk somewhere in his house.
I hope so. I hope that's like how he, like, you know, he like did Skype calls with actors and stuff to try to get them in. It's just like, I'm gonna get a do a Skype call with Kyle now. Yeah.
And we're talking about how awesome all that is, but of course there's a very bittersweet quality to this scene, because we get a scene with Doc Hayward.
Yeah.
Great character on the original show. Warren Frost comes back to play him in this short scene. Warren Frost is the father of Mark Frost.
Yeah.
And Warren Frost died earlier this year, I think February of 2017. So he is one of the many actors on this revival who shot a scene and died before it aired.
Yeah.
So him, Catherine Coulson, Miguel Ferrer, who seemed to be kind of in better shape for his scenes, but he still passed away. But yeah, so we have this last little scene with him, and you can tell he's kind of sick, but he's still really good in that scene.
Yeah.
And again, I think Robert Forster does so much to sell that this is a real thing happening between two humans. And that's hard.
And, like, it sells not just that it's a real thing, but it's, like, also a real thing that is happening over a Skype call.
Yes.
Like, there's the right kind of, like, delay that's not, in like, an actor not knowing how to act against, like, a screen that has, like, a green fucking thing on it or something. It feels like an actor deliberately putting in, like, you know, that kind of delayed response you have when you're talking to someone over Skype and, like, the connection's kind of weird. And you're like, aha, that's great. Like, you know, it's got that pacing to it. But also you, like, get a sense of, like, the history between them. Even though, obviously, again, like, the Robert Forster character, that Sheriff Truman, never existed in old Twin Peaks. Like, all that relationship has to be implied.
Yeah. So, you know, there's the little thing about, like, you know, Doc Hayward says, you know, send Harry my love and all that. But then we do get more missing pieces from the 25 years, where Doc Hayward met Dark Coop after he came out of the Black Lodge. And like Diane later and other characters we hear from, knew immediately that something's up with this guy. And also we get the detail that Audrey Horne was in a coma at the time because of, as they say, that business at the bank, which I love has been canonized in Twin Peaks.
And which is the first time I've ever caught them mentioning it, which felt like was one of the big question marks of what do you do with that? Because that's the weirdest fucking thing from the end of Twin Peaks.
Apparently, Mark Frost wrote this book, The Secret History of Twin Peaks, that came out in 2015. And I guess that does detail that in the bank explosion, Audrey survived, but the other two people died. So the character we didn't care about and the Jackman's character.
Right.
How they both died. So kind of interesting, and we'll probably learn more about that. Of course, we also get an intimation that Cooper went to visit Audrey. So I think there's a lot of sexual violence implied in these episodes.
Yeah.
So we'll see what comes of that. We will talk about that later when we get to Diane. But my favorite moment of this scene is Sheriff Truman's last line to Doc Hayward is, "Keep working the sunny side of the river, Doc." That's one of my favorite lines in any Lynch thing.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. It's just the way Forster delivers that. Beautiful little line.
Yeah. And it's one of the things where, like, that whole scene, because, like, that scene, like, half of it is them talking about the case and sort of getting information about that. And then half of it is just learning about, like, what Doc, like, them talking about, like, fishing and stuff, because that's what Doc Hayward is doing right now. And that, I love that dynamic of that it feels very much in a lot of ways like a scene that would have happened in old Twin Peaks. That is that kind of like, you know, good old Americana, like, you know, out in like the Midwest, oh, where we go fishing and drink coffee and have apple pie and all that. And we haven't had a lot of those scenes in this new Twin Peaks. I think it's one of those things that's really interesting about it is that that's one of the most like good old fashioned kind of scenes in this reboot. But it also happens over Skype, and I feel like that's really important. Like, that is one of those things that feels like the way that the modern world has changed the ways that that kind of Americana exists now.
Well, you talked about, you know, thematically last week, it really has started to feel like so much of what this revival is about is the passage of time and the way things and people have changed.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of that in this episode. I think particularly with Sheriff Truman dealing with that, where he is kind of the last healthy man standing among all these old people around him.
Yeah.
And he's kind of having to navigate the world through that. And, you know, so much of this is just Robert Forster is this guy. But I think also Lynch's direction and the writing and all that, he just feels like people I have known in my life in the Midwest. Like, you know, my father was a pastor in this little town in Iowa. And, you know, when we go back and visit, he feels like people in that parish or something, you know, in this little farm town in Iowa. And I just, you know, I was Washington and stuff, but it's that right kind of, as you say, Americana.
Yeah.
They get so perfect. So after that scene, we finally get out of Twin Peaks, after a surprisingly long stretch in Twin Peaks. And then we cut to South Dakota, and we have that military lady from a few weeks ago, Lieutenant Knox, who's going to investigate the prints on this body, and it turns out that is Major Briggs. Before that, though, we do have, she comes to look at the body, and they take the sheet off, and she sees it's headless, and she says, "Where's the rest of him?" And the detective just shrugs.
Yeah.
I laughed so hard at that. It's great. But no, it's, and then she gets on the phone with,
Ernie Hudson. Yeah.
And says, just two things. The head is missing, and he's the wrong age. And I love that. And so, like, yeah, this body is in the...
I love that, like, Ernie Hudson says, what do you mean? And you feel like she's supposed to follow up on, he's the wrong age. Which, like, yes, the head is missing is weird. Saying that a body is the wrong age is really weird. And she starts explaining the head part. And I thought that was really funny.
Yep. So, yeah. But, yeah, we see this body is still in the late 40s. Briggs should be in his 70s. And through all of this exposition, we have a shot where it's tight focus on the foreground. And in the background, we have, because it's out of focus, a shadowy figure moving through. And when we find some scary, like, Lynchian music going on, we finally cut to, like, a side angle on Knox as she talks to the other people. And the homeless guy just crosses through the frame. Don't hear from him again.
Yeah. Like, because at first I thought it was, like, going to be the assassin dude from the last episode that comes up at the end of this episode. I didn't know, like, how he would fit in, but I thought, like, what the fuck is going on? Like, it's so... Because it's a really creepy scene. Like, the way it's shot is so good, and the slow pacing of it. And it's like, what the fuck is going to happen?
I think there is... And I'm being serious here. I think there is some kind of Lynchian Grim Reaper in this series. I think we saw him in the box in episode 1. We saw him in the prison in episode 2. We saw him here. I think you could argue we've seen glimpses of him elsewhere. In kind of always in different bodies and forms. Yeah. But there's some kind of like embodiment of death moving around. And I'm curious to see where that goes.
Yeah, but like I said at the top of this discussion, like it felt like it was a scene that just like fell out of Mulholland Drive somehow. With like the ways it's like, it's one of like kind of like the most unsettling creepy scenes you've ever seen. But also is nothing. Like it has no connection to anything. It means nothing. It's just like, it just happens. You're like, what the fuck?
Yep. So great. This is all, again, tying together. You know, maybe in the first two episodes, we didn't know how this South Dakota thing was going to tie in exactly to the Twin Peaks stuff. We knew that Evil Coop was involved somehow.
Yeah.
We didn't know exactly how. And now we know that this body is Major Briggs or has a connection to Major Briggs. Something weird is going on.
Has the fingerprints of Major Briggs and is the right age for when he originally disappeared.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. And then we cut to Gordon Cole.
Yeah, right.
And here's something I forgot to mention in his first appearance in the first four episodes. Gordon Cole has in his office, and he just sits there in front of it, a wall-sized picture of the atom bomb going off.
Uh-huh.
I love it.
Yes.
What the hell? It's so great. Yeah, and Albert walks in and tells him, you know, that he didn't get to talk to Diane. And we have Golden Cole goes, "This is not good news, Albert." And then he asks if, you know, we can go find her again. And Albert says, "Say please." And Gordon Cole goes, "What?"
"You heard me.
Please."
Yeah.
God bless Miguel Ferrer.
He's so good.
Thank God he got to do this before he passed. It's what a swan song.
Mm-hmm.
Just a great character actor going out on top. And then we move to Diane's apartment, which is this swanky, like, 80s apartment. She's got some fling there, or I don't know if it was her husband or boyfriend or whatever.
Yeah.
And she is holding a coffee, and she's drinking a coffee and smoking a cigarette. Says, can we have a cigarette? No. And I don't have any cigarettes either. Or no, she says, can we have a coffee? Yeah. No, I don't have any cigarettes either. And then she takes a drag, because she's awesome. It's Laura Dern. Oh, my God. Apparently, Gordon Cole took up, or gave up smoking, which I think is crazy, because David Lynch very much has not.
Yeah.
David Lynch, I saw a documentary about him. I'll talk about that later, maybe. He smokes in every scene of it, so it's wonderful. He drain smokes like a motherfucker. And then we have the great Gordon Cole line, Diane, this might require a slight change of attitude on your part.
Yeah, because, like, the part we haven't talked about is, like, Diane is the most foul-mouthed character.
Yes.
Like, other than Frank in Blue Velvet, there is no more foul-mouthed character in all the David Lynch canon than Diane from Twin Peaks, which is not the direction I would have thought, but is the direction we needed.
Yep. God, she's... I love that Laura Dern gets to do this with another David Lynch turn. She has been in 4 David Lynch productions, in Blue Velvet, in Wild at Heart, in Inland Empire, and now in this, and she has never played remotely the same character twice. Those are all vastly different performances.
Yeah.
Laura Dern is a national treasure.
She's great.
God bless her.
Yeah.
She's so good in this. We have that scene on the plane where Agent Tammy is showing them the fingerprint discovery of, like, the mirrored fingerprints for Evil Cooper. And we get this whole monologue from Gordon Cole about the spiritual finger. I didn't even have time. I transcribe a lot of this. I couldn't even get it down. I don't know what it was, but it was wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
because that's where he, like, has this whole random phrase that he goes through all the fingers and says, like, a word for each of them, and then he just points at, like, your ring finger, basically says, and this is the spiritual finger. It's like, what the fuck do you think you just said? You could have just said this was the spiritual finger, and I would have believed you.
And I can absolutely imagine David Lynch just improvised that on set.
Yeah.
And it's just like, roll with it.
It's utter nonsense, but it's so good.
So good. And then we have the big kind of set piece of this episode, even though there's multiple ones, is at the prison, and Diane interviews Dark Coop, and that is a showstopper of a scene.
Yeah. Because we also haven't spent, like, a lot of, like, time with him, with Evil Coop, in a while. We had, like, the one great scene, the last episode, 2 episodes ago, where he was on the phone, but even that, like, he was kind of, like, off to the side, like, you weren't, like, directly interacting with him in that scene.
Yeah.
And so this, you know, it's like a mirror to, I think was episode 3 where they, or maybe episode 4 where they interviewed him the first time. And so now you have that kind of same interview scene with Diane with, like, the weird voice distortion and everything. And I kind of had forgotten again, that's like, because you don't spend that much time with him, evil Kyle MacLachlan is fucking scary.
He's really scary. Like, he does not play that as a joke at all. Like, I remember in the first episode when he rides up on the motorcycle with the heavy metal playing, we both thought it was kind of funny. I don't think he's funny anymore.
No.
He's scary.
He's scary. I mean, he's just like, hello, Diane. He's like, okay.
Like,
oh, God.
Here's why you almost said earlier that, like, we didn't get much Coop in this episode.
Yeah.
Because you forget it's Kyle MacLachlan.
Mm-hmm.
He's so... Because the whole... What that scene needs to do, and it's all on Laura Dern and Kyle MacLachlan, is have you convinced that Diane can look into this man's eyes and not see the good man she once knew.
Yeah.
Even though it's the same body. And we have to be equally convinced of that. And because of those two performances, and I think that the atmosphere of that scene, you buy it utterly.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite things they do is that it's a shot reverse shot, and when you get to Diane's shots, all you see is Laura Dern. It's a completely black background. I don't think there's any prison interrogation room in the world that is that dark and scary.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a completely, she is just in utter darkness. He is in utter shadow. It's a fascinatingly shot scene. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, this dialogue that very much intimates something happened with them shortly after he got out of the Red Room 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And whatever it did fucked up Diane something good, and she is very broken from that. But she also, like, this is a weird catharsis for her, where she's like, yeah, that's not the Dale Cooper who was my nice, weird boss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a, like, really unsettling scene, but yeah, it sets up, like, interesting. There's a lot of stuff in this episode that, like, it resolves some ideas and shows you things that, like this series has been building up to. So I feel like this has been something that's been building up since episode 3 and 4 to get this kind of this interview, and so it kind of resolves some of those things it was setting up, but raises these really interesting questions for, like, where it goes in the future, particularly for I think it's like setting up a lot of interesting plot lines for whenever or however Cooper comes back in some way, and having to sort of deal with the utter ruination of his life that evil Cooper has wrought, you know?
Yeah. It's going to be really interesting, yeah, because I thought about that with this episode, that there are all these people who love Dale Cooper but have been hurt by this bad version, and how can he ever have a relationship with them again?
Yeah.
How can he have a relationship with the world? Like, not that it's ever does us any good to make predictions of where a story is going in this. It's almost easier to predict a version of this where he, like, goes over the cliff with Dark Cooper Moriarty style rather than, like, living through the series, you know? And right before they go over the cliff, by the way, is when he finally wakes up and becomes Dale Cooper again.
He's like, grabs him and says, that's a damn fine cup of coffee, and falls over the edge. Like, yep. Oh, it's Cooper! Oh, it's Cooper!
Yep. I can imagine that very easily. Anyway, and then you have that scene outside with Cole and Diane talking.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good. She has this monologue, and I love it. Laura Dern is so good in this. And she says, that's not the Dale Cooper that I knew. It isn't time passing or how he's changed or the way he looks. It's something here, she motions to her heart, something that definitely isn't here.
Yeah.
And then we have Cole saying, that's good enough for me, Diane. That's good enough for me.
Yeah.
God, that's a great scene.
Yeah, it's like the one of the many elegant character things they have done with this return is with Gordon Cole and like getting this, like he is both funnier than he's ever been and like more like ridiculous than he's ever been in some moments, but he's also this really effective dramatic character in his interactions. Like here you get it with Diane.
Yeah.
It's great.
He's so good. All right. Let's see. One plot point we have not talked about yet is there's two little scenes with Andy where is investigating. I think it's the truck that killed the kid.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah. And in the first scene, like the guy says, no, we're not going to talk here. And so later you have Andy on the side of the road and the guy doesn't come. And you don't learn a lot from those scenes. Yeah. There's a shot that shows Andy having a nice watch. And I've seen some people predicting like, oh, is he a crooked cop now? I kind of doubt they'd go to that place. I don't think that's what they're suggesting.
Like, he did get married, like, maybe that's, like, an anniversary present or something.
Lucy would buy him something nice.
But I do really love that, like, the second scene with Andy, where it's, like, there's no dialogue. Like, you just see him waiting on the side of the road for a little bit. It's one of those, like, nice, quiet little, like, moments that they feel like they exist mostly for, like, the tone and pacing more than, like, what they're telling you about the plot.
It's also the second time in this series where we've gotten Laura Palmer's theme again.
Yeah.
But this time it's not the love part of the theme. It's the early, like, dark part over the trees.
Yeah, man. Yeah, because we don't get a lot of old Twin Peaks music. And so, yeah, that definitely helps set the tone there.
All right. Then we have a series of scenes where Dark Coop is meeting with Warden Murphy. And he says to the guard, like, just tell him I need to speak about a strawberry. And that gets him a meeting with Warden Murphy. Here's the monologue. The dog leg. That dog had four legs. One you found in my trunk. The other three went out with the information you're thinking about right now. Two people you don't want coming around here if anything bad happens to me. Joe McCluskey. I love this scene. I love the idea that Dark Coop escapes from prison by having the warden just let him out with a car because of information I think and I hope we never learn what that is.
Yeah.
I never want to know what Mr. Strawberry is. I don't want to know what Joe McCluskey is. I just love that somewhere in the ether, Dark Coop had a weird interaction with this warden and he knows some weird dirt on this guy and it's enough to utterly terrify Warden Murphy into letting him go.
Yeah, and I like how it builds up Evil Cooper as, like, you get this sense of, like, he probably has dirt on the warden of every single fucking prison in every state of the United States of America. Well, like, it's, like, he's been, like, the greatest criminal for 25 years or whatever, you know? Like, he has been everywhere, he has done everything, he has fucking killed everybody he can kill, he has been in, his fingers have been in every criminal enterprise that exists, you know, and it, like, you get that sense of his, like, sort of omnipresent evil there. That's really effective.
No one will ever hear anything more about Joe McCluskey or your late Mr. Strawberry. And then we cut to Dougie, and I wrote in my notes, Dougie, all caps, and then, like, 20 exclamation points.
Yeah.
Because I was so happy.
Because it is, like, because we have been so attached to the Dougie storyline, he's been our anchor for so long now. That is, like, you were cut away from him. And I think, like, being so cut away from him highlighted that for me. Something about like that the Dougie storyline has been giving us that is something that is like inherent to Coop from old Twin Peaks but has now changed is like it's the warmth of that character and the warmth of being with him. And it's something that like because of how different he is, it was hard to sort of like identify that like that feeling is still there, even if it's sort of transformed with this new kind of character he is now. If you cut back to him, you're like, you breathe the sigh of relief because it's like, it's been so cold being away from you, Dougie. Like, I need you back in my life. I need you in the show to make me feel comfortable again because I was feeling very sad and alone.
And we get another great Dougie scene where the three cops come to ask about the car, which apparently is the one that blew up. And Janie E gets there just as that's happening. And we get another show-stopping moment from Naomi Watts.
Yeah.
Who just tears these guys down. And we have this great line. She's describing the car. And she finally says, the kind they call down at the dealer, a previously owned car. That is a great line.
Yeah.
And she's describing the car. Oh, man, it's great. And then there's the whole thing about, why didn't you report the car stolen? And she has this whole rant that starts with, yeah, I'll tell you a reason. There's more to life than cars. And then she goes off on all this. And she just intimidates everyone around her. And then we have Dougie just repeating random words like, stolen?
Yeah.
It's so great. I love that. And that's our little comedy scene for the episode. Yeah. But then it leads up to our crazy scene for the episode. Well, one of our many crazy scenes for the episode, but maybe the craziest, where they're walking outside and she's ranting about how if you hadn't blown that money gambling, we could have gotten you a great new car. I just love Janie E. And then as she's ranting, the dwarf-like assassin...
Yeah. The Spike, or whatever they call him in the credits.
Ike the Spike.
Ike the Spike.
You know, Ike the Spike. The credits are some of the best parts of this show, because the names they've given characters are wonderful. Yeah, so Ike the Spike runs up to kill Dougie, and Dougie just suddenly snaps into action like he's James Bond, beats the assailant down, and as he's grappling for the gun, the brain head evolved arm thing from the Red Room is there saying, squeeze his hand off!
Yeah. And then he disarms him, wrestles it away, Ike the Spike runs off, and then you have like all like the weird like on the street interviews with the people as the police are investigating it. And there's just this incredible shot of the gun on the ground with just this fleshy attached to the grip because of like apparently Coop has gained super strength along with like the clairvoyance or whatever he's been exercising at the casino and everything. And so he was like grabbing onto the hand and trying to pull away the gun so hard that like this big chunk of flesh like grafted onto the grip of the gun. And so you have like this like cop dude, like of the crime scene investigator guy, just like slowly trying to like peel it off. It's like, Jesus Christ.
Sean, you're forgetting the best part of that scene.
Yeah.
It's one of the interviews with people. It includes the line, Dougie Jones, he moved like a cobra.
Yeah.
I want a tattoo of that. Yeah. Dougie Jones, he moved like a cobra.
And it's just like Aiden Cooper doing like a judo chop.
Yep.
Because that's like what he's... Because he grabs the gun and he's like chopping like the spike in the fucking neck. It's so good. Because it's so shocking because he's been moving at 0.5 miles per hour for literally 8 fucking episodes. And all of a sudden, he just fucking like judo chops this dude into submission.
Yeah, I love it. Oh, it's so great. So again, when people say nothing's happening in the Dougie scenes, things are happening.
Lots of things are happening.
And this was one of them where we actually got full on, like, Ike the Spike has been built up for a couple episodes. We got the confrontation. It was a big surprise here, and it paid off.
Yeah, like, because there was, like, half a second there where I thought, like, Naomi Watts was going to die or something.
Yeah.
It was so shocking. I was like, surely there's going to be some character death here. Luckily, we were spared that.
Luckily, Douglas Jones, he moved like a cobra.
He moved like a cobra. He's been trained.
Now, we then had a really long, and I thought amazing, scene in Ben Horn's office.
Yeah.
Where we actually got our first significant scene with the Ashley Judd character. We saw her in the first episode. She's like his new assistant. But now we're there. They're both standing. This felt more than, to me, any other scene of this entire revival, like a scene from original Twin Peaks.
Yeah, I feel like if you pulled old Twin Peaks music of like the weird like jazzy stuff and just put it over that scene, you would not blink. Like, you'd just be like, yeah, no, that's just from old Twin Peaks, that they like reenacted the scene from old Twin Peaks with older actors.
The way it was shot, the way it was lit, and the way it had, it's about them, they're trying to find where this hum is coming from, and the way the hum continues through the entire scene. It's the soundtrack to the scene.
Yeah.
And that you keep having these, like, personified shots of the lamp and the tiki statue. It's very much in line with, like, the template Lynch set in original Twin Peaks. Yeah. So I love that. But they're trying to figure out what that thing is. They can never find it. As they're searching, Ashley Judd, her character, her name is Beverly, has found that key ring that the hooker put in the mailbox a few episodes back, has gotten
Jade,
there.
Jade, please.
Let's, Jade, okay.
Come on.
I forgot her name. Jade.
Jade gives two rights.
I bet she does. No, so Jade put in the mailbox, and Ashley, Beverly has it now. Ben is surprised to see it and realizes, hey, this is the room where Cooper was shot. And you can tell, like, especially when she leaves the scene, this has some effect on him.
Yeah.
And because of how far that key has traveled, I'm pretty damn sure it's going to play an important role somewhere.
Yeah,
because
I think you combine that with the diary stuff from the beginning of the episode, and, like, there's a mounting enough of evidence to be like, okay, we know there's something crazy going on with Coop, and now they have a way, because the key came in through the mail, to get the general location of where Coop maybe is.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're setting up enough plot points to follow, to track that back.
Again, to my novel comparison, this is episode 7 out of 18. This feels like where we should be in chapter 7 of an 18-chapter book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway,
this is also where you get Ben Horn up to his old tricks. There's, like, weird sexual tension between him and Beverly,
who, like, I think is having none of it.
Yeah, probably having none of it. It's, but he's that old fox.
He's an old fox. Hey, he is still a handsome dude, Richard Banner.
I mean, he looks like David Letterman.
He does. But anyway, that's a good scene, and Ben explains about Cooper was shot there, and she says, "Oh, who was Agent Cooper?" He says he was investigating the Laura Palmer thing, and she says, "Who's Laura Palmer?" And he says, "Oh, that, my dear, is a long story." I love that.
Yeah, if you want, we can load up Netflix.
Yep. And then the scene ends with this long zoom in on the lamp, and then it moves to this mask on the wall, and then into the wall itself, and fade to black. That is an ending to an episode of Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. Now, the episode continues.
Yeah.
But that's great. We actually follow Beverly home. She's got some nurse or caretaker. Her husband, who is not a character we know. I thought at first maybe it was supposed to be someone we know.
Yeah, I thought maybe it was going to be like Leo Johnson or something.
Yeah, it's
in wheelchair. I don't know.
But it's not. Yeah. It's not an actor who's been on the show before. He probably has cancer. Their relationship seems strained.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll learn more about Beverly. That was interesting. At the Roadhouse.
Yes.
We have.
This fucking scene.
We have an extremely long take of a guy sweeping the floor, until he gets all the litter off the floor, and then finally the phone rings. I love that shot.
It's so good. It's just so moody. It's one of those things that I totally get that is a scene where a lot of people are probably going to, like, utterly check out. But for me, it's like the whole point of a David Lynch directed whatever is just to get in the fucking flow. And there's something about this episode is like think about all the shit we've talked about already. There's so much stuff packed into this episode in terms of plot that I feel like, you know, it's kind of unlike David Lynch to have it be that compressed and have, like, that much shit going on all the time, that it's like you just need to, like, swing hard in the other direction and just, like, have. Well, the one thing I liked is it felt like it's the flip side to what is, like, maybe the best shot in Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, which is the shot of, like, the bottom of the floor of the bar where, like, they dance, and it's like that whole, like, crazy dance scene. It's just like cigarette butts and ash and, like, discarded fucking beer cans. It's just like the most disgusting fucking floor ever. And then that shot does this, like, match fade with the, like, mountainsides, that we get a very similar shot earlier in this episode. I don't remember where it was. But this was like you kind of...
It's before Andy is out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because that's where the music starts playing, is on that shot. And here you get, like, he's just slowly sweeping all that crap up, and you watch it for, like, 3 minutes or whatever. Like, you watch it for the entire amount of time it takes this dude, this janitor guy, whose entire job is, like, to start, like, sweep this floor and, like, clean the tables and all that shit. You just get to watch him do his job. It's this, like, one static shot. And then the phone rings and it moves on.
I mean, it's an exercise in duration. I've talked about this before with Lynch. It's an avant-garde tradition, is your duration things, like, you know, your Andy Warhol films and stuff. And like most good exercises in duration, it actually is a very interesting composition.
Yeah.
Like, something is transfixing about the act of watching this litter pile grow and grow and grow. And it's just meditative, and it feels very right in that moment, even if you can't pin down why it feels right. But then the barman answers the phone, and this is, of course, Jean-Michel Renaud, the third member of the Renaud family, played by the actor who played Jacques Renaud, who died on Twin Peaks, but now he has brother Jean-Michel Renaud, and they are still involved in whoring and stuff, and sex trafficking.
Those fucking French-Canadians, man, you can't trust them. I know that Yves Guillemot looked really cuddly on the Ubisoft EA or E3 press conference. That dude's into some deep shit. French-Canadians, man, you just can't trust them.
So I'm interested to see where this goes. This is probably connected to all the stuff with, like, Richard Horne and,
like,
and
the drugs.
And, this is all coming up, I think. We get a final shot at the or scene at the prison where shot.
That unbelievable fucking shot with Evil Coop stepping out with, like, the whole prison and the dude with the flashlight at the end.
And the silvery shadows.
It's just fucking an amazing shot.
Amazing. And he gets his buddy and they go off and he makes the dude drive because of course he does.
Yeah.
And I love that. And then our final scene of the episode is we have this overhead shot on the forest of Twin Peaks, and I wrote a foul wind blowing in the air because I imagine that's what they wrote in the script.
Yeah.
And then the end scene is at the diner at night, and everyone's just kind of there celebrating, or not celebrating, but having a good, like, you know, end of the evening. And our credits go as people eat at the diner. And that's one of my favorite little interstitials we've gotten for the
you
credits.
You get a little bit of the patented Heidi laugh near the end of the credits. It's good.
You know what I think would be a great feature for the DVD, if they have any features, is I want, like, credits-free version of the credits shots from all these episodes, because they're, like, whether it's the musical performances or the thing with the statue or this, they're such beautiful little interstitial takes. I want to, like, kind of like on, you know, anime, they do, like, credits-free credits.
Yeah.
I want that here, too.
Me too, yeah.
Because they're just, they're beautiful little shots to see those play out at length, and you can just imagine everyone kind of having fun going about their business in these scenes. And, you know, Lynch will use it how he uses, but I think he's... I love the way they do credits on this show.
Yeah, me too. It's I like that, like, it's this weird, like, movie-style scrolling credits, too.
Yep.
It's like, I like that it feels like the credits are a part of the episode.
Yep.
And I like that it sort of incorporates that.
Yeah. So, packed episode.
Yeah.
Amazing episode. This thing just keeps getting better and better.
It's so good. Desperately want a poster of that shot of Evil Coop in the jail. Like, it's such a fucking good shot.
It's German expressionist worthy. Yeah. Like, it's like something from, like, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which you've got, like, a poster of over here.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, where it's just these long shadows, very, you know, like, almost painterly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just fucking crazy.
This is, guys, this is the entertainment highlight of the year for me. More than any movie, TV show. We had Persona 5 and Breath of the Wild, so maybe I won't say video games, but I don't know. Even then, this is something else, guys.
It's so good.
It's
it's one of the things where you have to understand people that are checked out on it. I totally get, I've seen, like, some frustrations online in places that I think, like, it's utterly understandable. It's not going to be for everyone with the pacing and everything, but if it is your thing... It is so good.
This is one of my favorite things Lynch has ever done.
Me too.
And I don't say that lightly. This is up there. Yeah.
Yeah, and I would never have expected it to be this good. Like, I didn't think it was going to be a train wreck or anything, but there was always, like, the concern, I think we talked about this, of David Lynch hasn't made anything in a while. Like, Twin Peaks got fucking really bad in season 2. It's like, how do you do this? And I don't think nobody could have come up with that answer except for David Lynch and Mark Frost. And thank God that they did, because fucking they found the answer. Like, they are doing it, and they are doing it really well. It is it both feels like Twin Peaks, feels like I'm being rewarded for caring about and loving the old Twin Peaks, and is also so crazy, so new, so creative, just it's so brilliant that it doesn't feel in any way hampered by old Twin Peaks. And that's something that there have been a lot of these kinds of, like, nostalgia revivals and stuff. You know, we have, like, the X-Files one, the Gilmore Girls one, all of these. And some of them have been successful. Some of them have not been successful. But this one is just, like, I think probably by the time it's done, it will have surpassed original Twin Peaks pretty handily.
In a lot of ways, yeah. This is amazing. So we will be back next week for more Doctor Who, more Twin Peaks, whatever the hell else happens.
Yeah.
Spider-Man's coming up.
Jesus Christ,
Spider-Man. We're both going to see the new Transformers this weekend, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's something we don't talk about a lot on this, is I'm a huge fan of, not Transformers, but of the Michael Bay Transformers. I love it to death. I'm really excited to see the King Arthur Transformers, and, you know, Sir Anthony Hopkins, I think, is going to bring the right kind of acting metal to the series that it's really been lacking up till now.
What if Michael Bay made a Transformers movie set in World War I? How insensitive could that get?
Oh!